Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Back surgery, weight loss surgery, cardiac care, incredibly complex medicine made easy to understand, thanks to the DMC. Join Emory King at DMC.org to see why, when it's serious, go to Detroit. Check out the DMC videos today at DMC.org.
Because this was the big week where the independent truckers were going to take off Tuesday, April 1st, although I sent out to my entire email list from calltalkyes@yahoo.com that it was April 4th, but I hope people figured it out, or they did it on both days. But I saw some in the paper that there were some convoys down these big highways.
Yeah.
It's all about the fuel prices, of course, people.
Right.
And I think they were in Atlanta. But I wonder if any of you listening actually took part in any of this, or anybody saw it, or anybody was inconvenienced by it.
Yeah, or if you know someone.
Yeah. Our phone number is 313-298. Hey, this is a little early in the show.
It's 313-298-WRIF or 313-298-9743.
Okay, and also the Hash Bash. Remember we had Adam Brook on from the Hash Bash. He's the MC for the last few years. And they were getting squeezed out of it. Often I go up there to the Hash Bash.
Yeah.
A few years ago, me and Drew and Mike from WRIF and Trudy, we all went over.
Right.
I still got my cool shirt from that we made up especially for that. But they were getting squeezed out by this student group.
And who had already reserved the Diag,
yeah,
which is where they normally hold it.
For the last 37 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it went off. But I want to hear from Adam Brook, and we're going to be calling him a little later. Also, it was an extraordinarily busy week for liberal talk show hosts.
It was, including you, in fact. You were nationally syndicated the other night.
I was. I sat in for Mike Malloy on the Nova M radio network. I'm going to be doing it again next Friday. But that's not even what I meant. That's great. I love those folks. It's an entirely different audience. And after doing this with the Riff audience for so long, it's different. I mean, it's an older audience.
Would you say it's, which audience would you say is, you know, tougher? You know, I think that our listeners here in Detroit take us to task.
No more. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most people, because it's a liberal talk network. Yeah. It's like 99.9% liberal callers.
Yeah.
And they all agree. And
a lot of preaching to the choir kind of thing. But
which I think is important.
But you all out there, you bring it on.
I bring it on, yeah. Yeah. But no, that's not what I meant. So to begin with, Debbie Stabenow's husband, Debbie Stabenow is the other Michigan senator, along with Carl Levin, and he was busted this week in one of these stings, this prostitution stings. He was he paid a prostitute $150 for a BJ. In February, this just came out. Tom Athens.
Is that the going rate? Okay.
Man, I just, I don't know what to say.
I don't either. I feel bad for Debbie.
Yeah, she's 57, he's 46.
Yeah.
And he's getting BJs from a 20-year-old.
Oh, my.
Yeah, he didn't get arrested, though. They, like, pulled him over, and he said, yeah, I was there. And he said, what'd you do? He said, we had oral sex, or whatever. How would you say that? Never mind, don't say it. She performed oral sex on me. How much did you pay? $150. They didn't have to.
Admitted it right off.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah, they didn't have to do any rendition or anything with this guy. He just blah, 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 like that. But he's connected up with Liberal Talk Radio because he is the chair, the CEO of, what's the name of this thing that he's on? Oh, yeah, Democracy Radio.
Oh, okay.
That has like Ed Schultz and people like that. I think Stephanie Miller. And also, he at one point was a big wheel in Air America, the larger of the liberal talk
network. The left-leaning networks.
Yeah. But then, also, Randy Rhoads, who just...
Who's a female, Randy.
Yeah, not the guitar player for... Yeah. Like, why am I blanking? Black Sabbath. But Randy, R-A-N-D-I.
She's hardcore. Now, I like Randy Rhoads.
Yeah.
I always like her style. You always say, oh, she's just way too harsh for me. But you know what she does? She says everything I want to say.
Well, maybe including this, because she's been suspended by Air America after repeatedly insulting Hillary Rodham Clinton at an event last month. I'm reading this now from an account. On March 22nd, Ms. Rhodes used vulgar language that likened Ms. Clinton to a prostitute at an event sponsored by KKGNAN. It's an Air America affiliate in San Francisco. And what she... you can say a word like whore, can't you, on the air?
Yeah,
whore.
We can still say that.
Yeah, but Randy Rhodes called her an effing whore.
Yes.
Yes.
Repeatedly. So,
yeah.
Okay, that's a little bit hardcore. And, in fact, I would not.
Not on the air.
Not on the air. And I don't think she is that. I'm not saying that that's one of the things I would like to say that she says. In general, I like what she has to say.
Well,
she
Randy,
goes right to it.
Yeah, a prostitute has, or a whore, has a number of meanings, including being a sex worker, someone who has sex, like this 20-year-old that was giving BJs to Debbie Stabenow's husband. Yeah. And that's pretty embarrassing, isn't it?
That's beyond embarrassing.
Okay.
You know, I mean, say, we know it's embarrassing for us to stumble through a word, you know, when we're on the air or something. Now, that is embarrassing.
Exactly. But also, it has meaning. And what Randy Rhodes was saying was that Hillary Clinton has sold out to corporate interests. That's why she was calling her an effing whore.
Right. Yeah.
So
there's that meaning.
So there was a discussion on this nationally syndicated show I was doing on Friday about whether it was inappropriate language and whether it was sexist and all this stuff. But it seemed to me, well, for one thing, it makes me nervous when management suspends or fires a talk show host for what they say on the air, let alone off the air.
Extremely.
Yeah. Julie and I, you've heard the story, if you're a regular listener, probably about 35 times before, but when we started with IE America in the year 2000, this isn't Air America, but a predecessor of it, we started off with 14 stations, and we were premature Bush haters. That was the problem. We were premature Bush haters.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, we were on to him right away.
Right away.
And we called him a liar. We called him a loser because he lost the popular election.
Criminal.
That he stole the criminal. Yeah. I mean, and Mike Malloy, who I was sitting in for on Friday, would always refer to Bush as...
Bushco.
No, that was me.
Oh.
Bushco was me.
Oh.
He called him the Bush crime family.
Crime family, right.
Actually, he finally agreed. No, he referred to him as the Bush bastard every time he mentioned him.
And he's hardcore.
He is hardcore. And he was losing so many stations. We were in a race to the bottom.
Yeah, to see who could lose more.
Yeah, he won. He wound up by the time they fired both of us.
No, we weren't fired. They sold the network.
Girl, I was fired.
Okay, well, I don't know if I was fired or not. All I know, I was in Puerto Rico. I came home and I to email saying, I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
like,
right.
For
no,
what?
We were out of there.
For what?
Yeah. But it wound up, Malloy had one station and I had two.
And they loved us.
Because he was harder core than I was.
Yes. So she is suspended indefinitely.
Yeah, what the hell does that mean?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But a whore is someone who sells one's services.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what Randy Rhodes was saying. Oh, I know.
A sellout,
kind of. So people were saying that was inappropriate language. I said, what are we, Republicans? I mean, for one thing, Republicans always say that was absolutely inappropriate. And then, of course, their secret life, we know about Republicans. Of course, these Democrats are kind of having secret lives as well. But there's a difference. That usually you don't find these Democrats going around saying family values and all that, and then hiring gay prostitutes and the rest of what they've been caught doing, having sex in bathrooms and
Wide stance.
Senator Wide stance. He's still in the Senate. He's still representing Idaho. I can't even remember his. Oh, Larry Craig.
Larry Craig.
Yeah, I was thinking just he would go down in history as Senator Wide stance.
If anyone wants to see Randy Rhodes, it's at peterwerby.com.
Yeah.
Right? There's a YouTube of it. So PETERWERBE. I saved it.
You did.
I took care of it for you.
I appreciate that. Air America talk show host Randy Rhodes suspended for trash talking Hillary, it says.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of trash talking going on
there
these
is.
Days.
But there's more. I mentioned Ed Schultz. Ed Schultz was a conservative Republican and a sportscaster. He turned liberal Democrat. And he called John McCain a warmonger at a Barack Obama fundraiser.
And to that I said, And so what?
Yeah. Well, where? I thought I had that. I went and, oh man.
Seriously, so what?
I had all, I went and got these definitions of monger. Usually, like someone who is a fishmonger, that's
oh,
an,
yes.
or an ale, A-L-E, ale monger,
yeah.
is someone who deals in the commodity. You know, or
right.
your, or like, what's his name? Debbie Stabenow's husband, Tom Athens, is a whoremonger. That's also a phrase. I mean, it's a real phrase. That's a real word.
Okay.
Yeah. So, to call, so, McCain supports this war, this horrible war that's getting worse by the moment. There's this enormous battle inside of the city.
The safe green zone.
Yeah, inside the city of Baghdad.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was
this,
today. It was a very bloody day over there.
You know, yeah, I was going to say, like, if you can imagine one in Detroit, but most of our suburban listeners couldn't imagine. But and there's not like the tight-packed residential patterns around here at all. But if you can imagine some battle in St. Clair Shores or in Dearborn, or if you're familiar with big cities, like the slum, Sadr City, has 2.5 million residents in it. And that's where these helicopter gunships and these F-14s and all that are dropping bombs and, you know, shooting rockets. And it's all part of the civil war. This Muqtadir al-Sadr is competing for the Shiite dominance within the Iraqi government, and we're linked to one side. And the thing is that the prime minister of Iraq has closer ties to Iran than al-Sadr does. I mean, it is so confused. And in the meantime, our troops are dying, our troops are killing. And for what? For what? And John McCain supports all this, so he's a warmonger. I mean, you could find, well, actually, here's what the Obama campaign said. They said, John McCain is not a warmonger and should not be described as such. This is a spokesperson. He's a supporter of a war that Senator Obama believes should never have been authorized and never been waged. He's a warmonger!
No, that is such a bunch of hooey.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody wants to be a nice guy as people are dying by the dozens. Right now, remember last week we were saying that we'd reached the 4,000 mark
right.
in...
dead U.S.
Yeah,
soldiers.
Yeah, now it's 4,018. 18 more, and you know and we all knew that, right? Well, that turns out not to be the case. Did you see that in Frank Rich's column today
I
in
did.
The New York Times? This would amaze those of you who follow the news and knew that this figure of 4,000, this ominous figure, this benchmark of 4,000 American combat deaths was going to be reached last week, and it did. But in Frank Rich, he talks about TET happened, T-E-T, and it's not like, you know, the S word happened. TET was a battle, pardon me, in Vietnam, I think in 1968. Yeah, it was, 40 years ago. And that's when the Viet Cong had this enormous uprising. And although they suffered the most losses, that was the watershed event, and everything was downhill for the U.S. invasion and occupation of Vietnam. So now, having learned nothing in the next succeeding four decades, the United States is into this quagmire there as well. But here's what Frank Rich says down into the column. For the majority of Americans who haven't met any of the brave troops who have been cavalierly tossed into the quagmire, the war is out of sight and mind in a way Vietnam never was. Only 28% of Americans knew American casualties in Iraq were nearing 4,000 last month, according to the Pew Research Center. That's absolutely amazing.
It really is. Although, I hate to say it, I'm not surprised.
Really?
I think that so many people are so disengaged when, you know, I get together with people and say things like that. They just kind of blankly stare at me and think, you know, I don't know if they feel bad for not paying attention or are just not interested. They're so desensitized, Peter.
I guess so, and I guess it just, what's the old Phil Oakes song? It only, I can't remember the verb, but only affects a small circle of friends in a way. I mean,
yeah.
If you come from a community that has a lot of soldiers, if you are relatives, you've been there yourself, because now there's like 500,000 men and women have, mostly men, but have been there. And here, actually, this may be worth reading from a little. Here's what's happening as we're talking. I mean, maybe it's kind of calmed down a little. But earlier today, a rocket attack on the U.S.-protected Green Zone on Sunday killed three American soldiers and wounded at least 31 people. The strike came after heavy fighting in a Baghdad neighborhood that left 20 dead and more than 50 wounded in the worst violence since a ceasefire was declared a week ago. Heavy fighting in a Baghdad neighborhood. Can you imagine living there? I mean, these are policy goals that the United States, political goals mainly, but military goals and political goals as well, that does not take into account the people that are suffering on either side. At least two rockets struck the sprawling green zone in central Baghdad. A separate strike happened in the southeastern part of Baghdad. The green zone has faced frequent attacks. Nobody has claimed responsibility, but the military in the past blamed Iranian-backed rogue Shiite militia groups loyal to cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Overnight, Iraqi troops backed by U.S. forces battled those fighters in Sadr City neighborhood. Officials at two local hospitals, it goes on, police said a U.S. Stryker armored personnel carrier was damaged in the fighting, continued with the exchanges of gunfire. Two armored Humvee vehicles, two trucks, gone. An Iraqi offensive against the Mahdi army in the southern city of Basra ground to a halt last week amid fierce resistance. Al-Sadr issued a ceasefire order, and the government agreed to halt raids against his followers in that. So here, we've spent now, and remember, I'm always trying to be precise, with pronouns. We, you and me, have paid for all of this. So we've spent half $1 trillion right. of our money so far. Something that's going to cost $2 to $3 trillion. And what part of it has been billions and billions and billions of our money in order to create an Iraqi fighting force? And this is sort of like a generation ago trying to create a Vietnamese fighting force that would do our bidding. Now I'm not being precise. Do the bidding of the U.S. government.
Right. There you go. It's $10.3 billion a month.
A month. Wow. Offensive against Basra was going on, more than 1,000 Iraqi soldiers and policemen either refused to fight or simply abandoned their posts during the inconclusive assault against Shiite militias in Basra last week. Iraqi military officials said the group included dozens of officers, including at least two senior field commanders in the battle. The desertions in the heat of a major battle cast fresh doubt. We're in the sixth year of this war, people, but it cast fresh doubt on the effectiveness of the American-trained Iraqi security forces. Well, do you think? This is just absolutely amazing. Now, and on Wednesday, Muqtada al-Sadr, the cleric who leads the Mahdi army militia, said that he's calling for 1 million Iraqis to march the Shiite holy city of Najaf next week to protest what he calls the American occupation.
Wow.
What do you mean, what he calls? What else is it? What in the hell are we doing in Iraq? 6,000 miles from our home, getting our troops killed, having them kill Iraqis. For what? We can't even tell what side is which anymore. Who's the good guys? The Shiites are aligned towards Iran. Both the government of Maliki and this guy as well. All right, we have on the line, though, at least something that came to a good conclusion. Last week, we talked to Adam Brooke, and Adam Brooke told us that the Hash Bash was in trouble. The Hash Bash is the longest, what do they call it? Longest going on? What's my word here?
Let's just stick with that.
Yeah, the longest going on.
That's not good.
The largest.
Longest running
non-advertised event, and it protests the war on drugs, the war against U.S. citizens. But as it turned out, a student group had last fall reserved the area of the University of Michigan campus, so-called the Diag, where this is traditionally held. But it had a good conclusion. Adam Brooke, thanks for joining us again on Night Call. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you.
Peter, Jalene, nice to be here.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Adam.
So tell us the story. Things came out all right in Ann Arbor this Saturday, huh? Yesterday.
Yeah, actually, they came out pretty well. This other student group who, like U of M Normal, has to apply for a permit.
Adam, wait a minute. Can you maybe go in a different part of your house or something? The connection sounds terrible.
What bar are you
at? I'm in my house. What do you mean, what bar am I in?
It sounded like there was a crowd.
Well, we just lost him. Nice going.
Did I offend our guests?
You insult my guests. And they're gone.
Al, can you maybe get him back on the line?
Yeah, please. Let's do it. Kevin in Canton wants to talk about gas prices. Yeah, I just read something that said it's going up. 313-298-WRIF. Kevin, you're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Go ahead.
Hey, what's going on, you guys?
We're just doing this talk show.
Yeah, gas prices are crazy. I mean, you know, with most products, the more you sell, the lower things get. The more you sell, you think that the prices would go down with products. I don't understand why gas prices, it wouldn't be the same thing.
Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, it's a little supply and demand thing, and the demand is kind of choked off, so that's their excuse. But essentially, we're being gouged. I almost said gauged. Yeah, gouged. You know, the price goes up, our pockets are empty.
That's right. I think Adam's back.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin.
Hey, man, we're sorry. We're sorry. We didn't mean to insult your phone.
Was it something I said?
No, I hit the wrong button.
All right, good.
Adam Brook from the Hash Bash is back with us. So the Hash Bash, traditionally first Saturday in April, went off, huh?
Yeah, we basically had this other student group who had also applied for a date on the Diag, and the university gave them our date is basically what happened. And the university played fast and loose with the truth, and I think they were looking for a fight, and we didn't give them one, but this group contacted us, and knowing that John Sinclair was going to appear, and of course this group is a group that their sole purpose is about communicating through the arts with
it's called
students.
Focus, fighting obstacles, knowing ultimate success. Whoa, focus.
And they're all about using hip-hop music and arts to communicate with students and bring each other together.
Well, that's nice.
That seems to be like the Detroit Artists Workshop in, 40 years ago.
So that's right.
It was perfect for us, and they invited John and I to address the crowd, and of course, Hash Bash is all about getting together and having a good time and smoking a joint and kicking back, and the university is not the place to do that, so we were happy to get out of there, to be honest with you.
Okay, but the rally took about a half hour, huh?
Yeah, the university actually told this group that if they allowed Hash Bash to happen, that would be a violation of their permit.
Really?
So, yeah, they when I got there, the police actually asked me what our plan was. And, of course, I told them my plan was to take over the world. And
there you go, man.
Yeah, they got a little nervous.
One bong at a time.
That's right. And but, I told them that, we had been offered some time, and the cops said, well, you understand if you hold Hash Bash, they could violate their permit. And I said, they've invited John Sinclair to participate in their program. They've invited me to participate in their program. You better check with your superiors. And sure enough, they walked away and came back, and they figured out that that would be a violation probably of the First Amendment, and let the thing happen. And basically, we were invited guests of this other group to do our thing. And, the university basically gave our permit away, and they did it early. They claimed that first come, first serve was what the spokesman said in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to apply a lot earlier than we have in the past. The rule generally is you can't apply for the permit until the first day of the current semester.
Well, Adam Brook, the campus cops at the University of Michigan at the Hash Bash says there's about 1,200 people in attendance. What do you think?
Well, there was a few thousand people. The Ann Arbor News claimed that the police got it wrong. The Ann Arbor News said there was at least 2,000 people.
Yeah.
They never won. I have photographs of the Diag with twice as many people that were on there today, and they said there was half as many. So, mm-hmm. they just play fast and loose with the truth. We're not surprised about that.
Yeah, John Sinclair spoke, and as it says here, I'm losing where this was, though, that he founded the, where is it? I can't even find it here. Anyway, but the White Panther Party was the manager of Detroit's MC5 and also best known for his marijuana conviction that led to a 1971 Free John Sinclair rally at the University of Michigan's Chrysler Arena starring John Lennon and a bunch of other people. And so Sinclair told the crowd, "I like to get high. I believe I have a right to get high. People want drugs," he said to Cheers. "They want to get high because it's all good."
Yeah, that actually was his a piece he does called "It's All Good," that where he talks about getting high in Amsterdam at the Cannabis Cup.
Oh, yeah.
And so he read that piece.
But drugs are dangerous. Let me take that back. Are potent substances, and people have to realize that, that, as we know so well, that there is a dark side to it. But it's true with alcohol, right?
Well, there's a dark side to everything.
Sure.
I think the United States is finding out that there's a dark side to things that we thought were everyday things, like sugar and salt and things like that, that killing millions of people and causing all kinds of health problems. Problems they don't have in Europe and Africa that we have here simply because of diet.
All right.
So, you know.
I'm cutting you loose. After that, I'm cutting you loose.
No problem.
What? So next year, another hash bash?
First Saturday in April, April 4th.
All right.
High noon. We're there.
Hey, give our best to John.
Yeah.
We will. We'll see him tomorrow. Actually, we're going to be back in Ann Arbor at U of M teaching a class tomorrow.
All right. So. Stay high. I mean, say hi.
We are, and
okay.
We will.
Okay. You're right.
Bye, Adam.
Adam Brooke. And you can go to, I don't know, just look up, if you don't, hopefully everybody knows what we're talking about, but you can go to either Hash Bash, if you can Google that, or John Sinclair, S-I-N-C-L-A-I-R. Do you realize the first syllable of John's name is Sin?
Wow. You're reaching.
I know. I am. Here's Cal in Roseville. Cal, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Going good.
Hey.
I just want to talk about the war. I was, like, shocked when he said 4,018 soldiers were dead in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't watch the news. I'm not watching the news, actually. But I think, like, no one can control these people, Iraqi people. You can't control them or even you can't rule them. I think the people, like, who need to rule them or control them, like, the communist Gorbachev president, or Lenin, I don't know, like, I don't get, like, 10.3 billion a month.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That's huge. That's a huge number.
Well, it also has to do, and none of the political candidates, one doesn't expect that, of course, from John McCain, which would be more of the same, who supports the war and supports an occupation of Iraq for 100 years, as he said, that that's the root of our economic problems, that we're throwing money down a drain, down a rat hole, and all of what you see, I mean, there's people on here that say they want to, you know, on our lines, waiting. They want to talk about the situation in Michigan, the economic situation in Michigan. Well, we wouldn't have any of these problems if that money was going properly where it should. Thank you, Cal. I appreciate your call. And we'll take one more call before our break. Here's Randy in Port Huron. Hi, Randy. You're on the air.
How you guys doing? Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. I'm doing good. I think Jolene's doing good. Yeah.
Good.
It's all good.
I was just talking to the gentleman that answered the phone. I just got back from Massachusetts this morning.
Wait a minute, Randy. Wait. There is no gentleman answering our phones. What are you talking about? Al, sorry. Go ahead.
But, I just got back from Massachusetts visiting my aunt and uncle. They actually had to move over there, you know, for job reasons.
Yeah.
I just wanted to tell you guys, which surprised me for being, you know, high-priced, housing over there. Gas was actually about 30, almost 40 cents cheaper over there.
Really?
Hmm.
Yeah, which I don't know why. I just thought that was interesting. You know, I figured I'd let you guys know about it. And,
well, yeah, think about California, where it's actually 50, 60 cents higher.
Exactly. It blew my mind.
So it's different distribution centers. You know, if you really look, you can find out the official reasons for it, but I think most of it is just BS. I mean, there's different ways that they can rip us off at different points of the distribution system.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Understandable completely.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks for the info. I appreciate it. I know when, let me see, a year ago, well, not even quite a year ago, my wife and I were in New Jersey, Cape May, New Jersey, and they cannot have, the law is, you cannot have self-service gasoline. There has to be somebody pump it. And it was about 40 cents cheaper, and a guy comes out and says, fill her up. You go,
really?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
I
don't get why it's so much cheaper.
No, neither do I.
And why they don't let you pump your own gas?
I'm wondering. Maybe to protect the petroleum transfer agents' jobs? You know, pump jockeys?
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
We're going to take a break. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And we're right back.
This is WRIF.com.
A present for you.
Big blocks of riff rock.
What are you trying to say?
It's a block party weekend on 101 WRIF. Blocks of your favorite riff rockers all weekend.
Amazing.
Plus, keep it locked in the riff for your chance to win tickets to the Monster Energy AMA Supercross at Ford Field, Saturday, April 12th. One lucky riff winner will also score four times the adrenaline with four seats in the front row. Great tickets to the Monster Energy AMA Supercross still available at all Ticketmaster locations. Click on Ticketmaster.com and get the special Riff discount tickets for just $10.01. The password is 101WRIF.
And the best way to start a fun-filled day of being a good citizen is
the Block Party Weekend from 101WRIF.
Hey, look at me. How else am I going to face the day?
Everything that rocks. Detroit Tigers want to send you on a rockin' road trip to see the Tigers take on the Toronto Blue Jays for not one, but two games. April 19th and 20th in Toronto. Want to get in on the action? Log on to WRAF.com or on Tigers.com/WRAF and tell us what you would do to see the Tigers in Toronto. You might win 2 nights hotel accommodations in downtown Toronto, $200 in gas cards to get you there and back, a pair of tickets to see the Detroit Tigers versus the Toronto Blue Jays on April 19th and 20th. at Rogers Center, plus sweet ripped wearables and autographed Tigers memorabilia. Rockin' on the road with your Detroit Tigers at 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Joined by Jalene Jordan. You can call and join us. 313-298-WRIF. I forgot to say, for the bashful and when the lines are filled, you can email us at calltalkyes, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Dan writes in to that Eddie, to help gas prices, maybe besides the truckers blocking roads, why not get all cars and trucks blocking roads?
Good luck.
Yeah, well.
I think it's a great idea.
You know, I forgot. Oh, man. Paul from DetroitLiberation.org, DetroitLiberation.org, had invited me to speak at this event, their Liberation Rally, and I was supposed to write him back. Oh, there's nothing in your email here. Oh, I see. You resent it. He says, oh, sorry about the previous one. Anyway, Friday, April 18th at noon in the Union Building on Grand River in Lansing, Facebook search Lansing protest war on drugs, whatever the hell that means. But anyway, but there's the Liberation.
Well, Facebook is like MySpace, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a Facebook search. Oh, you can do a Facebook search
to find it.
Lansing protest war on drugs. Okay. Yeah, they were partying last night. Did you hear that? There's a huge riot there, and cops had to tear gas all these.
In Lansing?
In Lansing, yeah. They do that every few years.
Really?
Yeah.
And was this sports related?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it was just a massive party.
Really?
But then there's Liberation Day, and that's Detroit's protest, are part of a worldwide event against the drug war. Saturday, May 3rd at the Grand Circus Park in beautiful downtown Detroit, noon to 6. James and the Rainbows. I love that. James and the Rainbows will play. John Sinclair will speak. Hopefully, Peter, you will speak as well. Would love all of you to be there. Let me see. What's the date here? May 3rd. I think I can do it. Paul, I'll get a hold of you. My apologies. Oh, he says he's ill. He probably got the leftover of that cold that everybody has. In any event, sure. Because this, sometimes people say, man, you know, there's so many important things to talk about. Well, they don't say man. The people that want to talk about drugs say, man. But the people that don't, they say, well, Peter, why are you talking about this? What about the war? What about the economy? What about Bush, Carl?
We cover it all.
Yeah, but this is extraordinarily important. Millions and millions of people have been victimized by this unsupportable war on drugs that has taken perhaps another $1 trillion of our, and I stress our money, in order to punish our citizens because they want to alter their consciousness, sometimes just by smoking flowers.
Right.
And if people are doing some sort of substance that you feel, or I feel, is sort of a risky deal that has a potential for abuse, well, that's an adult's decision. It's not the part of the government to decide for us. This is way back to these laws that were pretty much Puritan in their origin. But now, of course, it's advanced to being part of the prison industrial complex. And the war on drugs provides clients for the prison industrial complex, which is this major industry, putting our citizens in jail because they want to alter their consciousness. Man, so I'm down with it. So they say. Hey, man. Like, I'm down.
I'm down, man.
Yeah. let's see. I'm looking at everybody who's... let me just get this one thing on the air. Pardon me. 81% in polls say nation is headed on the wrong track. I actually read this on the national show that I did, and it was introduced by AC/DC's song Highway to Hell. Highway to Hell. Americans are now more dissatisfied with the country's direction than at any time since the New York Times and CBS poll began asking about the subject. 81% of respondents said they believe, quote, things have pretty seriously gotten on the wrong track. And that's up from 69% a year ago and 35% in early 2002. That's when Jalene and I were losing all these stations because two-thirds of the people thought everything was just going swimmingly, right?
Yes, those weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. Now, who are the 19%? That think things are just going well. 21% of respondents said the overall economy was in good condition.
I mean, these people have got to be living in their own little fortress of of denial. And I imagine wealth.
Yeah, they're living in this near this river in Egypt. Denial.
Right.
That's right. That's my dentist told me. I wanted to tell you this story. Respondents are more pessimistic when asked in general terms about the next generation, with only a third saying it would live. In other words, that's younger people saying it would live better than people do today. That's kind of depressing. But this is weird. 58% of respondents said they would support raising taxes on households making more than $250,000 to pay for tax cuts or government programs for people making less than that amount. So that sounds pretty cool. People realize that the $250,000 and up bracket, which represents the upper 5%, so 95% of the people make less than that. So 58% said, yeah, tax them more. But I'm thinking 42% said don't?
Yeah.
I mean, what is up with that? 43% of those surveyed said they would prefer a larger government that provided more services, which is tied for the highest number since the Times poll began. But an identical 43% said they wanted a smaller government that provided fewer services. Well, I got to tell you, folks, you 43%, you're probably going to have your way.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah, look at your roads. And you're going to need it, though, because as jobs vanish and prices rise, food stamp use nears a record. In fact, I think it is a record. Doesn't it say that here? Do you have that article?
I do have that.
28 million people are going to be getting food stamps, and they get the grand total of $100 a month to live on.
I think it's $150 for the bridge card here in Michigan.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. One example is Michigan, it says in this article from the New York Times, where 1 in 8 residents now receives food stamps. 1 in 8 residents. And by the way, everybody who's eligible is not getting them. Maureen Sorbitt, who I know, who's a spokesman for the Michigan Department of Human Services, who's run by my friend Ismail Ahmed, she says our caseload has more than doubled since 2000. We're at an all-time record level. The Department of Human Resources is going to be having a conference on poverty this fall in Detroit. So we're going to be on top of that as well. The climb in food stamp recipients has been relentless. Wow. Reflecting a steady loss of industrial jobs that has pushed recipients levels to new highs in Ohio and Illinois as well. Isn't that sweet? And there's 19% of the people, well, no, the economy, 23% of the, 21% of the people said things are going fine.
Yeah.
What planet
are you living on?
They're on planet Rich Guy.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan here with you. Here is Craig. Craig's in Adrian. Hi, Craig, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how you guys doing tonight?
We're doing terrific.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
The food stamp amount you were talking about, from the people I know, you're about 20 to 70% below what the average people I talk to are getting.
Really?
Yeah. But
wow.
What I really wanted to talk about was my personal views on why we're in Iraq and we'll probably be there until George Bush is gone.
Oh, and way beyond.
Let me just stop you 1 second. They're talking about troop levels for 2009 and 2010. One of the things that Bushco is setting up, they're setting up a situation where they're going to be handing the Democratic, they're figuring that a Democrat could pretty sure thing to win. So they're going to set the Democrat up in a manner that's going to ensure a catastrophe in Iraq, which will, of course, impact both our soldiers and the Iraqi people, but will have a politically negative impact on the Democrats. These people are so evil. But go ahead. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I got a friend of mine just came back from Iraq, did two tours, and in his view, he says, I don't have any idea why we're there. They've been killing each other for thousands of years. They're not going to stop because an American steps on their soil.
Yeah. But the question is, why did we ever step on their soil in the first place?
Well, that's hidden deep in the annals of the Pentagon. We'll probably never know.
Well, you know what? Actually, I don't think that's the case. That's been the case. Like, when you find out about the lies about World War One, when you find out about the lies of the Vietnam War, that comes, like, 30 years later. But because of the availability of information now, people are going to find all of this out pretty quickly. I mean, most of us know by now that at a minimum, Bushko was so catastrophically wrong about weapons of mass destruction, the rationale for going in there. And, I mean, tons of people knew that wasn't the case, but if you wanted to give George Bush the benefit of the doubt, which I don't, because I think they purposely lied, they knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, and but it was a part of their larger scheme to control oil, to have military bases, and to and also, given the imperial nature of the Bushko administration, to show that nothing would constrain the power of the presidency, which they thought were going to be in their hands for generations. All right, thank you so much. Appreciate
your
call.
Yeah, best to your friend.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for adding that, Jolene. Here's Sonny in Ypsilanti. Sonny, hi. You're on WRIF. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm doing great tonight. How are you guys doing?
We're good. We're good.
Okay. Well, I wanted to call and touch on, I heard the gentleman talking about the hash bash that happens out here in Ann Arbor every year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I attend it every year, and every year that they've had that petition out there, I've signed it. And what I really have a hard time understanding is, you know, in Prohibition days, they illegalized alcohol. And when they had enough trouble with it, they finally legalized it. Now, the way that I look at it is, how many times do I read the newspaper, watch the news or something, and there's something kind of death related to alcohol?
Right, sure.
Whether it's through violence or liver cirrhosis or something, psoriasis of the liver.
Drunk driving.
Hello, drunk driving. You know how many people, Sonny, have died last year from marijuana, don't you?
No, I don't.
Zero.
Exactly.
Zero.
Point. When was the last time you heard about somebody? You know, and this is a capitalistic country that we live in. I can't understand why our government can't see the profit behind something like this. Because marijuana, I mean, like me for myself, okay, I have a slip disc and I have a hernia. Right now, I don't have insurance to pay for the medicines for the pain and stuff. So what I do, I smoke it myself.
Yeah.
And it takes care of my pain for me.
And you know, that ain't nobody's business if you do. So why is the government trying to make a criminal of you, no matter what your reason is? I mean, most people these days try to rationalize it, saying it has medical usages. Well, it's not the government's business what you use some substance as an adult, once particularly since you've been informed as to what the government thinks are its negative aspects, which I don't know what they are.
Yes,
does the government still say that there are some, I don't know what, some problems with marijuana? What I don't even know what their official nonsense is these days.
Well, you know, I don't really get it either, you know, and you guys also touched on this and everything. Years ago, I did a little time myself for having marijuana.
Really?
You know, and that took a lot of tax dollars to incarcerate somebody over marijuana, when there are people out here committing crimes of violence and nature, you know, when they should be focusing on stuff like that. I wasn't a big time person, nothing like that, but they prosecuted me because I wouldn't quote unquote snitch on another person.
Yeah. I mean, friend of mine, I've mentioned him before over the years, who went to jail and who wouldn't snitch, went to jail and 1989, and is going to get out a little early next year, 2009. So he's going to do 20 years for helping people do what they wanted. I mean, where's the victim here? I mean, since he was dealing controlled substances, and every person that bought from him, fully aware of potential dangers and what have you, but it's decided by society that this cannot be allowed. Terrible. Absolutely terrible. All right, thank you. Go ahead, Sonny. What?
I was just going to say, I have traveled coast to coast over the last 3 years of this beautiful country of ours.
Uh-huh.
And
in every city that I've been in, I have run across people in every walk of life, from people that live in multi-million-dollar homes to people that live in trailer parks, people that, as we say, partake of the earth.
Partake? Well, yeah, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and in some states it's either the number one cash crop or the number two. All right, I got to move on. Thank you, Sonny. Say hi.
Stay pain-free.
Stay pain-free, yeah. Yeah, who would deny him that? Yeah, well, the government.
Yeah.
Right. Here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, you're on the air.
Oh, my.
You're out of here, man.
Maurice, what are you doing?
Maurice was at the bar.
I think he was with Adam at the bar, yeah.
Yeah, wow. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Mike in Waterford. Mike, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing good.
I was out at the hash bash yesterday, too, and the guy, I don't want to put your promotion down, but that guy, John Sinclair.
Yeah?
Man, I'll tell you what, he just makes people who look like, you know, who like to smoke weed or enjoy something like that, he made you look stupid because all he talked about was, like, getting high instead of, like, you know, telling people to who to vote for, how they can vote in a way, you know, towards people who are more, you know, how do I put it? They're going to promote the legalization of marijuana, you know?
I think what he was doing was he's a poet now, and that's what he does, and so he was probably reading poetry about that, and I think that Adam even mentioned that he was reading a poem that he wrote when he was at the Cannabis Cup. You also have to understand that John Sinclair lives in Amsterdam, where things are a lot more open, and so he feels probably a little more free about it, and he has every right to.
Well, I'll tell you, Mike, you know, if there at different times during the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, I don't know if in this century or not, people have made concerted efforts like to put this on the ballot and have tried in more traditional political ways to bring this to the attention of politicians or to create a referendum. But I know what you're saying. You would have preferred a much more sort of straightforward political rally where, for instance, like if there was an anti-war rally where people would say the war is bad, here's why, here's the amount of money that's being spent negatively. Is that what you mean?
Well, no, it could, you know, not in a necessary hardcore political rally sense, but it could have been more educational. You know, I guess he probably did just read from a poem, you know, and I don't even smoke weed no more, you know, but I'd still promote the legalization of it because of the fact that, you know, you can basically cut down killing the rainforest and stuff because you can start using it for paper and, you know, things of that nature where you don't have to kill trees no more, you know.
Yeah.
Hear what you're saying, but he's an artist. You know, that's really what he's become more than anything is a poet and an artist.
And everything and everybody isn't everybody's cup of tea because, as I was saying earlier, when the syndicated talk show host, Randy Rhodes, called Hillary Clinton in this club appearance an effing whore, a lot of people were extraordinarily offended.
Yes.
Offended. That is not the way to talk, people said. So now there's this big debate among liberals about should she have said that? Should she have talked like that? I mean, shouldn't we have had reasonable discourse? Well, I don't know. We don't live in an era of reasonable discourse. But, you know, I hear you.
Point taken.
Sure. All right. Thank you, Mike.
But I also have to say, John Sinclair is one of the sweetest guys going out there.
Love that guy.
Yep.
Here's Jack in Utica. Jack, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Hey, Peter, one thing I want to say. This isn't why I called, though, and I don't want you to get mad. Let me just say this. I love potheads. You know why? Because they can't live near me. They don't have the money, and they never will.
You know what, my friend? You are so wrong.
You are so wrong.
Yeah.
I know a lot of potheads who are loaded.
Yeah. And do all sorts of drugs. And, right. I mean, I've known, I always say
this. How about
this.
Every rock band we play at the station?
That's right. So all the wealthy musicians who think Utica is a slum. Right? But also, I've known cops, lawyers, prosecutors, judges.
Lawyers.
Who else? Corporate guys. Yeah. So, all right.
What else?
Okay, here's the question, Peter. You heard about Bill Cosby. He's a black comedian, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, you heard that, what, about a year or two ago, he said that the black people were giving excuses. Okay? And now he's an outcast in his community. He said the black people can rise up and do anything they want. They've had affirmative action for 50 years.
Yeah.
Now, 3 weeks ago, you said on your show.
The black people. Wow. Go ahead.
All the blacks and the Asians and the Latinos just don't have the same opportunities as those damn doggone whites.
What the hell are you talking about?
You, don't tell me you didn't say it. You said that on your show 3 weeks ago. You said that these people here, the Latinos, the blacks, and the Asians, still don't have the same opportunities as the white people do. And here a black comedian comes out.
A black multimillionaire. Who's making aspersion? You know, there is nothing like black people. I mean, except that there is a category of people who have darker skins. But in terms of culture and social class and education and all that, they're as different as we are with people that have white pigmentation, as we call it. And a guy like Bill Cosby, who rightly has been criticized for saying that that any group of poor people can elevate themselves simply by attaining certain skills, is crazy. There is a class system in this country, you may have noticed, which is getting worse. The middle class is eroding. The working class is losing income. Yeah. And the poor are getting poor. So if the poor spend all their time trying to get education, of course they can't, because there is not free university education, so the most they could ever get was high school. And if you listen later tonight, you'll hear about the conditions in Chicago high schools that are just abysmal, where there's a teacher there who I interviewed who was trying to make the best of a bad situation. Actually, he was trying to mobilize these students around the concept of getting a new high school. That it didn't have a lunchroom. It didn't. They had to sit with their coats on in whatever. So there's something nasty, Jack, about your whole attitude, which I really don't even want to continue with. But thanks for calling. We'll be right back. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Home of WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and where Riff is rocking the streets. Check out Motor City's Deals and Deals and get stuff for half price. Or your 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Website
worldwide. 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
And the more I see, the less I
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to our second hour. Joining me in the WRIF studios, Jolene Jordan.
Yes, and you know what I've decided? I was having dinner earlier, and one of my dinner mates said, you know, there's something in the air this weekend. I'm feeling it tonight on the show.
Okay. One of the things you can do is go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, and you can see that Randy Rhodes, the suspended Air America talk show host, trash-talking Hillary, calling her an effing whore, and that's what got her suspended indefinitely.
Bad girl.
Bad girl. At 1 a.m. Eastern time, Brian Schultz, he's the teacher I was talking about in the Chicago schools. He has a book, Spectacular Things Happen Along the Way, Lessons from an Urban Classroom. And also Michael Rubian, co-director of Life is for the Living. It's about stem cell research, of which, yeah, I started asking him questions like, what is a stem cell?
Right.
I didn't know.
Well, I've had a couple of friends who have had lymphoma and gone through stem cell, and they're fine now.
They didn't have it here.
Amazing. Yes.
I thought you couldn't do it here.
They haven't made it illegal yet. They're trying to, I believe. But maybe we should listen to the interview and I'll find out.
Well, I do know that Michigan has one of the most restrictive stem cell research statutes, brought in, of course, by the right wing, the religious right.
It wasn't in Michigan. I can tell you that.
Yeah, right. Well, here, Mike wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Ooh, it is a little long, but I can do it. Here's 10 things you should know about John McCain. More of the same, I'd say, and this kind of proves it. John McCain voted against establishing a national holiday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He now says his position has evolved, yet he's continued to oppose key civil rights laws. Number two, according to Bloomberg News, McCain is more hawkish than Bush on Iraq, Russia, and China. Conservative columnist Pat Buchanan says McCain, quote, will make Cheney look like Gandhi. That's scary.
He
looks like
terrifying.
Such a nice guy. You see Letterman? Letterman was saying that McCain looks like the guy that makes your keys at the hardware store.
I can see him in a smock right now, right?
Hey, I love those guys.
I love those guys.
Yeah.
I just like to see John McCain wearing a smock.
Yes.
And a little name tag.
His reputation is built on his opposition to torture, but McCain voted against the bill to ban waterboarding, then applauded President Bush for vetoing that ban. McCain poses a woman's right to choose. He said, quote, I do not support Roe versus Wade. It should be overturned. Number five, the Children's Defense Fund rated McCain as the worst senator in Congress for children. He voted against the children's health care bill last year, then defended Bush's veto of the bill. He's one of the richest people in a Senate filled with millionaires. The Associated Press reports that he and his wife own at least 8 homes, yet McCain says the solution to the housing crisis is for people facing foreclosure to get a second job and skip their vacations.
His wife is the one with the money.
Yeah. He divorced his wife. His first wife got in this horrible car accident and was disfigured. So, she gone.
Oh, and, right. And his... Now,
Number seven, many of McCain's fellow Republican senators say he's too reckless to be commander-in-chief. One Republican senator said, quote, the thought of his being president sends a cold chill down my spine. He's erratic. He's hot-headed. He loses his temper, and he worries me. Number eight, McCain talks a lot about taking on special interests, but his campaign manager and top advisors are actual lobbyists. Number nine, McCain has sought closer ties to the extreme religious right in recent years. The pastor McCain calls his spiritual guide, Rod Paisley, believes America's founding mission is to destroy Islam, which he calls a false religion. McCain sought the political support of right-wing preacher John Hagee, who believes Hurricane Katrina was God's punishment for gay rights and called the Catholic Church the Antichrist and a false cult. Mm. I mean, how are they banging Obama over this Reverend Wright?
For real.
Yeah.
And if anyone, seriously, after reading that list, how could you still want to vote for the guy, even for a second?
Yeah. The Straight Talk Express. Yeah, something else it should be called. And number 10, McCain positions himself as pro-environment, but he scored a zero. Yes, zero from the League of Conservation Voters.
Okay, that's pretty bad when you score zero.
Yeah, I mean, most of these right-wing senators will get like 10, 11, out of 100, like 100%. But you get zero. This is like...
I didn't know that whole thing about his wife in the car accident.
Yeah, it's really creepy. Very, very creepy.
You whiz.
Here is Dan in Monroe. Dan, hi, it's Peter and Jillian. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Peter and Jillian. How you doing?
We're doing good.
Well, I just went on a call tonight. I'm concerned about the state of affairs in the state of Michigan and, more importantly, Detroit. I work in Detroit for Daimler Chrysler, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And when I started working in Detroit, I was kind of indifferent about it, but I've always loved Detroit. I'm a diehard Lions fan, Red Wings fan,
sure.
Tigers fan. And with this issue with Kwame Kilpatrick, I was hoping you guys could maybe inform me more than what the news has been able to do as far as why hasn't Jennifer Granholm stepped in.
I don't know what she actually could do. I mean, there's always all this political crap involved, and I don't want to lay any of that on Governor Granholm because I don't know. But Kwame Kilpatrick and his mother, of course, are big political players in the Detroit area in terms of getting out votes. And it would be, and again, I don't want to put this on Governor Granholm because I don't know this for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me, for instance, if she doesn't want to mess in it because of the contentious nature inside the city of Detroit and the ability of the Kwame machine and the Cheeks Kilpatrick, his mother's, ability to deliver votes. And that's a guess, but it's just an ugly part of the kind of political world we live in.
Well, I can understand that to a point, but when I heard about the Black Mayor's Convention canceled because of the state of affairs in Detroit.
No, they did. I didn't even hear that.
You didn't hear about that?
They canceled a meeting here in Detroit?
Yeah, Black Mayor's Convention. It was going to be held at one of the new casino hotels, and they all canceled because of the affairs in Detroit.
Yeah.
And that's money lost for the state of Michigan. That's money lost for Detroit.
I got to tell you that I don't think that the conviction of Kwame Kilpatrick, either for perjury or some of the other charges, is a done deal. And it's very possible that he could weather all of this. But it seems to me that just either common decency or common sense, and particularly if he cares about the city of Detroit, which he claims, or if he cares about the fortunes of even the Democratic Party inside the city of Detroit, which is being just ripped in half because he says, I'm staying there no matter what. What would be the consequences? What would be the negative consequences if he was to resign? I don't think any. What would be the positive? I think this would all go away pretty quickly, and he could deal with his legal problems on his own. So, yeah, Kwame Kilpatrick certainly should resign. All right, thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate your call. Here's Al in Inkster. Al, who didn't get a date with Jolene for the hash bash, go ahead, Al.
He's asking out to a few events.
Yeah. Go ahead, Al. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Al. Did you go to the hash bash?
No, he didn't have
No, I had to work.
Oh, okay.
I work for a living.
Oh, okay.
I hate when that
happens. I got off work at 6 a.m. and had to be back in at 1 p.m.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not cool.
Wow.
That's typical if you're blue collar.
Yeah.
You were talking about Jennifer Granholm and Kwame Kilpatrick.
Right.
They're political allies from way back.
Are they?
Yeah, they both got started in politics with the former county exec, McNamara.
Uh-huh.
You know, and Kwame supported Jennifer. Jennifer supported Kwame.
Yeah.
But under state law, Jennifer Granholm can remove Kwame Kilpatrick.
Because he's indicted?
That's not the basic reason for any reason that makes it look bad.
You mean the governor can just say, I don't like the mayor of. What is it? What's that city now? Rockford? Yeah. Isn't there downriver? Isn't that Rockford? Yeah. I don't like the mayor of Rockford. You're out of here.
She can come up with a good enough political reason to do it.
Wow.
It has to be an official that's making the city or the state look bad.
Yeah. Well,
I guess he's doing that.
Yeah.
I think Kwame does that.
Yeah. Well, let me tell Let me tell Al, our phone screener, that Kwame is spelled K-W-A-M-E. The way you have it with an I, it looks like he's a magician or something. You know, the amazing Kwame.
Rafi.
All right. Well, thanks for the heads up.
It's okay, Al. Both of you.
Actually, don't.
Have a good night.
Wait, Al. Wait. Somebody said, you are, and don't, if you know who I'm talking about, don't say their names. But someone said to me, I hear our friend Al from Inkster on your show all the time. Do you know who I'm talking?
That's entirely possible. Well, I've got a lot of people I know hear me and go, hey, I heard you on the radio last.
Wow. 15 minutes. Well, not even. Let me see. Where's the counter here? 2 minutes and 25 seconds of fame. Go for it.
Oh, hey.
Thank you, Al.
Have a good night.
All right, you too.
Bye, Al.
Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jeff in Detroit. Jeff, must have seemed like you were waiting for a long time.
Yeah, somewhat. How you doing?
Yeah. I'm fine. Thanks.
What I was calling about is, first of all, I like to state, I don't drink alcohol or smoke pot, but I think they should decriminalize it.
Sure.
You know, they really should have learned a lesson from prohibition that criminalizing doesn't do nothing but make a criminal enterprise out of the thing. That the countries where a lot of the stuff is legal have no more addicts than we do.
Yeah, but you know, Jeff, you're making sense. So that.
I'm sorry, I really didn't mean to.
How dare you make so much sense?
But kind of seriously, I mean, there's so many things in this society that you would think that common sense would tell the politicians who are, in charge of things that this ain't the way to go about a particular issue, and there they go.
Not just politicians. I can't tell you how many arguments I have gotten into with people, you know, because I think that they should decriminalize a lot of the different drug uses, you know, that a lot of people is like, oh, you just want people to be going around getting high all the time. I said, no, it's not that. It's just that when you one is something that you're doing to yourself, and that's your right. And two, that when you do criminalize it, you're not stopping nobody from trying it, using it, or anything. All you're doing is just filling up prison systems with people who are, you know, trying to make a buck off of it.
Mm-hmm.
and raising the price. You know, as if they were to decriminalize it and you could grow it in your backyard, the price of marijuana would drop considerably.
Sure. Well, you know, I agree in general with what you're saying. I'm sure the illegality of it is a barrier to some people. For nothing, no other reason, that the price is artificially jacked up and you'd have to worry about legal consequences. And so it could be that it does prohibit or acts as a prohibition to some people from actually utilizing it or utilizing it more or whatever. But when you weigh it against the social harm that this society has suffered in terms of wasted money and wasted resources and the wreckage of people's lives, because of the drug laws over the last 50, 60, 70 years, so far outweighs the damage that people would experience if it was universally available. And as you said, the people that really want to get high, in fact, the people that have problems with substance abuse, that doesn't act as a prohibition at all.
No.
Yeah. All right, Jeff, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Al is sending us some notes. Belle Isle Rock Guy says he loves you.
Well, we love you too.
Yeah. And
rock on.
And when I was criticizing Al's spelling about Kwame's, that does it. I'm taking my navigator and going home. That's a Detroit joke, folks, which if you're listening elsewhere. I wonder if we're streaming. We haven't heard a lot of people when I did that national show on Friday said they were going to listen, and we haven't gotten a single, maybe I should look at my email. That ought to be here. I'll do that right now, although I don't know. It's just the best way to go about it. No. Huh. That's weird. I don't think anybody, maybe we're not streaming. But anyway, if you're listening somewhere else in the country or the world, let us know, okay? Let's see. Here's is it Monty in Waterford? Is that your name, Monty?
Monty.
Monty. Hi, Monty. You're on the air.
Hey, great.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, listen, my boy brought home a movie the other night, and I watched it. It's called Zeitgeist, the movie.
Zeitgeist.
Zeitgeist?
Yeah.
And I watched it, and it really flipped me out. I don't know for sure to believe it or whether it's, I mean, everything in it is factual. I've looked stuff up.
Well, you know, well, that's good. I mean, first off, that you guys start checking some. That's a film about 9/11, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, it's in three parts, and the first part's about religion. The second part is about 9/11 being an inside job. And then the third part is about the central banking.
Well, a third of the population, according to a study, I'm surprised not more, think that 9/11 was an inside job. You know, I don't like getting information from films because you don't, even though you were checking, that's the such an important way to go, is that when you're reading, you can kind of stop and you can think about it and you go back and read things over. But
I paused the movie whenever I came up with any kind of, if it was going faster than what I can read. And so I'd pause it and read everything that was on the screen at that time, you know, and then I'd advance it and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, people think
so,
I'm part of the cover-up, but I don't think it was
anything. Get out of town.
Just because I don't think that it was a conscious. No, well, let me put it this way. It wasn't an inside job in the way that demolition was set inside the towers and that somehow that this was instigated by the Bush administration. They're pretty awful, and I shouldn't say pretty. They're completely awful, but I don't think this is something that they would have even chanced pulling off. And a conspiracy of the size that is portrayed in movies like Loose Change, in Zeitgeist, would involve so many people that it would be almost impossible to keep it a secret. And what's happened, I think what will come out, rather, is that we'll find out, hopefully soon, that the Bush administration knew that some attack was coming. I mean, Bush got this memo saying Al-Qaeda to strike in the United States, and they did nothing. He went on vacation. And they had plans that as soon as Al-Qaeda would strike anywhere at any U.S. asset anywhere in the world, that then the United States would invade Afghanistan and would look for the excuse to invade Iraq. So I don't know if you have to accept everything in Zeitgeist to know that they allowed the greatest catastrophe of security and death toll in the United States in its history, and that the Bush administration is responsible for it. That's my take on it.
Yeah, I get the same impression. Well, the CIA is working for Bush. You know, King George the First was in charge of the CIA.
He was indeed. His daddy.
Yeah.
His daddy. Yeah.
And Kennedy came out with a speech that was talking about doing away with. He was going to dissolve the CIA. And the guy that was head under Bush at that time was his brother was the mayor of Dallas.
Well, you're talking about the assassination of John Kennedy?
Well, it goes back that far.
Yeah, but
it goes back further than that. In the central banking part of the movie, they talk about how Granddaddy Bush was making money selling. He had a special blend of gasoline that they had a patent on it, and the only way you could get it was to buy it from them.
Mm-hmm.
And the dive bombers that the Germans had only used that gasoline, so they had to buy their gas from from these guys that ran around together, and Bush was one of them.
Well, yeah, his family has a pretty checkered history, and if people don't believe this, all you got to do is Google something like Prescott Bush Nazis, and you'll be amazed at what you come up with. But any number of U.S. corporations helped build the Nazi war machine in the 1930s, including the Ethel Corporation, General Motors, Ford, who actually bailed out Hitler and the Nazi Party in the early 1920s, and who Hitler was presented, not personally, but presented Henry Ford with the Iron Cross in Detroit, in Detroit in 1938. There's a lot there that is just sort of glossed over because we want to have our heroes, right? All right, thanks for bringing that up, Monty. Appreciate it. Keep on checking it all out. Here's Stella in Hamtramck. Stella, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to call and correct something that Al said. And Jennifer Granholm can't remove anybody from office unless they're actually convicted of a crime.
I would think that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, and you know, the best definition that I heard lately of the Iraq War is that it's nothing but a transfer of wealth from the American people to Bush and his buddies.
Well, sure, that's what it's all about. It's about, I sometimes use the phrase transfer of wealth, but it's looting, essentially. We're being looted. We work, they loot all this money for it. Well, look, here. In the Nation magazine, in the, what is it, March 31st edition, they have this thing, class war, who's losing and who's winning at home from the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And it says, cost of the war to the U.S., $522.5 billion. And the cost to Cleveland, which they say is a city kind of similar to Detroit, they've already lost $479 million. And it goes through this whole deal about 50,000, what that would have bought, 50,000 homes with renewable electricity, 25,000 children would get health care, 14,000 people getting health care, on and on like that. But Stella, I think the interesting part, that's interesting too. That kind of information is interesting too. But it says, who gets the money instead? Private military contractors accounted for almost $300 billion in 2006 war spending, up 63% since the invasion. And the income of the highest paid military contractor is CEO Robert Stevens of Lockheed Martin, who made last year $25 million. All Lockheed Martin does is make stuff for war. So you and I and the rest of us, Stella, have paid this guy $25 million. He's looted us.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bush is the great uniter. He's uniting the middle class with the poor.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep. That's another good one.
And,
yeah.
But, you know, I have to tell you, though, Robert Stevens of Lockheed Martin and his $25 million is kind of unusual. The average income of CEOs at the top 30 military contractors is only $9 million. You'll be pleased to know.
Oh,
yeah.
Babies.
Median household income in Cleveland in 2006, $26,500. So, can you do math? If how many times more? What's 26,000 and 26 million? How many? Is that 1,000 times more? 100 times more? I'm sorry, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Oh, you're asking me?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. I've just had my first cup of coffee. I know.
Well, welcome.
Welcome to the day.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a midnight person.
There you go. All right, rock on.
Night owl. We are streaming live, by the way.
Yeah, thank you, Stella. How do you know?
I've received confirmation.
Via
my...
Would you stop texting when we're on the air?
I found out before anyone else, didn't I?
Let's see here. Okay, yeah, you're streaming. You're loud and clear in Milwaukee, writes Rick. Let me see some of these places here. David says, Spring, Texas. Thank you, David. Call talkyes@yahoo.com.
Great.
You're streaming just fine, says Mr. Thompson. But it doesn't say where. I mean, he could be anywhere, right?
Yeah.
This is moving a little slowly. Greetings from Sacramento, says Marty. Alice is streaming in Rochester, New York.
Wow.
Let's see here. Also, Mo is in Dearborn. But you could just listen to 101.1.
But hey, maybe there's not a radio in his office.
He says, you're streaming, my friend, but I'm in Dearborn, so take it for what it's worth. If you get on an Arab-related topic, I'll chime in. Love your show.
Ah, okay.
I don't know what to make of that, but whatever. You can
Thanks
always
for
bring,
the love.
Yeah, you can always bring it up. Am I missing anybody here? Yeah, let's see. Steve in Chicago is also listening. A lot of these people have written me over the months and the years. I never knew where they were from, so that's cool. All right. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening on the big stream.
Making us bad nationwide.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. All right, so let's continue on here. Here's Bill in Lincoln Park. Bill, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
We're doing good.
I'm tired of hearing how black people always need a hand up. I mean, I understand there's a division between rich and poor and everything else, but I grew up incredibly poor, having to use food stamps. I was Southwest Detroit. I was, picked on a regular basis for being one of the only white kids. And? To be told that I don't deserve college scholarships that are available to other people, or that I have to test higher, or that I shouldn't be hired because of the color of my skin.
Well, I don't think, wait a minute, that doesn't ever go on. First off, let me just tell you, before you get into this complete resentment thing, which is so unnecessary and so unbecoming, and you're not looking at where the root of the problem is. Institutions, the government, corporations, banks, employers, whoever, was involved in systematic discrimination against minorities. And then they tried to, and women, too.
Yeah. Oh, I was right there with you.
Yeah. Right.
I knew you meant me, too.
Yeah. And, of course, women are majorities.
Yeah. Well, I thank you.
Yeah. Right. Because they outnumber us.
Yes.
Men. But so in order to level the playing field, they initiated a generation ago affirmative action. So these groups that discriminated previously against one group discriminated against another group in order to make it equal. So it was never the people involved. That's it. I mean, the people that are always saying, you know, the black people, like that, they don't have that same kind of hostility for banks. They don't have that same hostility for government. They don't have that same hostility for corporations.
Yeah.
They want to bring it out in this angry white man resentful crap.
And against an entire race of people.
Yeah, who some are middle class and many who were poor and have become, against all odds, have become successful. But there is two things. One, it ultimately is about class, that it is extraordinarily difficult for people to rise in the class structure, that most people that are poor remain poor, but that there is disproportionately people of color, which would include black and brown people, among the poor than there is white people. There's more white people that are poor in absolute numbers, but percentages are greater. So why is that? You can either say, because they're always complaining that they're being victimized. That's a load of crap.
But how do you really feel?
I hate talking about this thing.
Well, it's...
Now you're...
It's angering me, and it's angering you, but that's just... I don't know.
Yeah. Can't we all get along?
Can't we please?
Yeah. Here's Bob in Ohio, so our stream is working. Bob, where are you calling from in Ohio?
Right near the border.
Come on.
Hello.
Give it up. What city?
Sylvania.
What is it? Transylvania.
Sylvania.
Oh, Sylvania.
Yeah.
Okay.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Nice show. I just, first time I'd ever listened to you guys. I was coming home from work, and I just happened to be cruising through the dial and picked you up.
Really?
Oh, actually, yeah. Must be one of those nights. Jolene said that earlier.
Yeah.
It's in the air.
It's in the air.
Telling you.
Yeah. Yeah.
This isn't a stream.
A very wise woman told me that.
I don't know where to start, man. The whole Bush Co. thing, you know, I'm in my late 40s, and I look at what has gone on in this country for the last 8 years, and I just get so damn depressed thinking about it. And the damage that's been done, I really think it's going to be generations. It's irreversible.
You know what? I hope it's not irreversible, but it will take generations.
For a while.
Yeah. No, well, you said two things. One is irreversible. The other is that it take generations. Some of the stuff that Bushko has put into motion, a lot of stuff about the environment and all that, is irreversible.
Well, just from the solely economic side of it, I watch stuff on TV about this, and they're saying that the estimates now are $6 trillion this whole mess is going to cost if we pulled out tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that's generations. And, you know, they could have fixed Social Security. They could have provided health care for every child in the country. They could have rebuilt every school in the country. It's ridiculous. I can't believe, I don't know what his approval rating is now, but it should be zero. I can't believe anyone would support that moron.
Well, there are whack jobs around. I guess it's, I see everything from under 30% to under 20%.
It should be 0%, man.
Yeah. Well, there's always...
Agreed.
But here, listen, in every country, particularly every Western country, maybe now every country in the world, it's what I call the fascist third, so that there's always like 33% that will support the ultimate ruler no matter how terrible he is and no matter how much he even hurts them. Because they're so in love with authority, they're so incapable of rebelling even in their minds.
Fearful.
I think the other factor that feeds into that is something that Bushko did a very good job after 9/11 is the fear factor, because I hear from people that support him better over there than over here. I don't know what that means. It has no basis in reality, but people believe that garbage.
Oh, in Iraq, you mean?
Yeah, because if we're not, in other words, the sentiment is if we're fighting them over there, because if we weren't fighting them over there, they'd be at our doorstep, running down our street, shooting at us.
Oh, this sounds like my father.
It's nuts.
This sounds just
really?
Like my dad. He got it right off of Fox News. He gave me that one on the phone, and I said, oh,
fair and balanced.
I told him to turn off the TV.
That's a
people
good
believe
idea.
That crap, though.
Yeah.
And what scares me is if we're going to have another turnout like we did last time with the right wing, you know, fundamentalists all showing up to vote the Republican in, it's going to be four more years of the same old crap.
Well, got to get Obama and Clinton to stop arguing.
Yeah.
And you know what? If that happens, three words. Well, it's really four, but I'm...
All right, don't...
I'm out of here.
Oh, I thought you were going to end your career in radio.
No!
Say, we are... Yeah.
Out of here.
Thanks for finding us. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
We're here every Sunday.
Yep, we are. And we'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan.
WRIF.com. 101 WRIF is giving you your shot at the big time as the Riff's rock correspondent for the biggest announcement in rock history from rock's most notorious band, Motley Crue. What's your big taste of being a music industry insider courtesy of the Riff? Just click on WRIF.com and listen to the music montage. Then log into your WRIF Cybercrew account, identify the artist in the montage, and you could be on your way to La La Land. You just might be flying off to Los Angeles on April 15, where you'll personally cover the press conference given by none other than Motley Crue. Log on now at WRIF.com for your chance to be the Riff's rock correspondent for Motley Crue. Exclusively from 101 WRIF.
Everything
rocks.
Fortune, babe, mirror, babe, don't insane, but the memory remains. Heavy rings on fingers wave, another star. Nowhere crowd trying to know.
Most WRIF contests are open to legal U.S. residents at least 18 years old. Winners may win only one contest every 30 days or every 6 months for prizes worth $600 or more. Employees and their family of Greater Media Detroit, its advertising agencies, and other radio stations in the metro area may not participate. No purchase necessary. Prizes are not transferable, and rules are subject to change at any time. Complete rules are available online at WRIF.com or at the WRIF studios during regular business hours.
Everything that rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to me and Jalene Jordan for our final segment, 1 a.m. Eastern Time. A couple of interviews I did earlier in the week. Brian Schultz, author of Spectacular Things Happen Along the Way, Lessons from an Urban Classroom. And also,
that sounds so happy, but really I think the content is pretty depressing, isn't it? I mean, as far as the reality of the schools.
Yeah, the schools are awful. Yeah, the kids are amazing. Michael Rubian, who from Ann Arbor, co-director of Life for the Living, I interviewed him, and also Amber Shin, who's a communications director of Stem Cell Research Ballot Question Committee, who's going to put this on the ballot. Here's a frightening item, and this just came in. But we've talked any number of times about Captain Paul Watson, who founded the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, who's out there stopping whaling, stopping illegal drift netting,
protecting the clubbing of the baby seals currently up in Canada.
Well, get this. Sea Shepherd Conservation Society ship, the Farley Mowat, was attacked this morning. This was 2 days ago by a mob of 30 to 40 angry fishermen. Now, what they're up in this, the French island, I don't know what they call it. It says the attack took place while berthed in the French islands of Saint-Pierre, which I looked up, and it's an island, or it's a city on an island in the mouth of the St. Lawrence Seaway. The Farley Mowat was berthed in Saint-Pierre to transfer video footage of the Canadian seal slaughter onto shore and await the resumption of the slaughter, which was temporarily suspended after the death of four sealers. These guys were just out in a boat that they shouldn't have been, and it's just a whole terrible situation. Tensions escalated in Saint-Pierre as the growing mob hurled rocks, threats, and insults at crew members of the Farley Mowat. Cameraman Simeon Houtman was assaulted by an axe-wielding fisherman after stepping on shore to film the incident. Captain, am I going to be able to pronounce this name? Captain Alex Cornelson, I think it is, requested assistance from the French police. Why is this French? I can't believe this is... The Captain Paul Watson from Sea Shepherd is Canadian, so he knows this stuff. But and he was one of the founders of Greenpeace. But they're calling it. They requested assistance from the French police, at least a half a dozen of whom were present at the scene, but did nothing to defend the ship or crew against the mob. Instead, the police suggested that Sea Shepherd should leave Saint-Pierre immediately, which was difficult for them to do. And then the mob severed the head and... Careful. Let me finish the sentence. You started, your eyes got big. The mob severed head and bowsprit lines, so this was ropes, from the bollards. Sea Shepherd crew members scurried to pull in the lines and prevent them from drifting back towards towards the screw or into the bow thruster. This is some nautical language.
Yeah. You're not speaking my language here.
Anyway.
Damage to the boat.
Yeah, the Farley Mowat was able to escape the hostile crowd at St. Pierre. The extent of engine damage sustained remains undetermined. Fortunately, all crew members were on board during the attack and no one was injured. But, here's what it is. These fishermen and these seal killers, this is their livelihood. So they see the Sea Shepherd as interfering with that. But, I mean, there's all sorts of livelihoods that shouldn't be. And clubbing baby seals is a livelihood that shouldn't be, for sure.
All right. I don't know how they sleep at night, but...
let's see. Let me do this a little more in order. Here's Will in Canton. Will, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. How are you?
We're good.
I've been listening for a while here, and I wanted to recap on a couple of things, if that's all right.
Sure.
First off, I was listening to Jeff, who was talking about the hash bash and decriminalizing marijuana.
Right.
I've heard from, a couple of reliable sources the reasons that we don't have legalized marijuana is that they're political, actually.
Sure, sure.
the main thing I've heard is that marijuana plants would give, I think, a certain amount would supply almost 85% of the ethanol that the country needs.
Well, I think it depends on how much they grow. But, ethanol, I don't know.
I just thought that was corn.
Well, yeah, but no, I don't know if you could make fuel, I think, from any biomass.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if it's just corn-based, but corn-based ethanol is an absolute disaster. It's part of what's driving up corn prices around the world. What do they call it? Zero sum or something like that. It takes so much conventional energy to create a gallon. It's about equal. It takes a gallon of conventional fossil fuel to create a gallon of ethanol. It's just another kind of like financial scam. But go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying there. And, but yeah, when you think about it, legalizing marijuana and selling it, and I'm sure just like tobacco, it would be taxed, and the government would make a lot of money on that. I think they're just worried about pressure from foreign oil sources, you know.
That could be one. I mean, that is one of the claims of the people that that support the idea that hemp has this incredible amount of usage, which it does. And it could be, I have a hemp shirt. I haven't worn my hemp shirt in a long time.
Yeah, I have some hemp pants.
Do you?
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had a hemp shake?
No, sounds terrible.
It's like a smoothie.
Like they have hemp toothpaste? I don't know.
Apparently there's some pretty good hemp cereal out there, too.
Really? You can buy all that stuff because it does not have... you don't get high on it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, right. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. We're getting a lot more people from around the country. Where did I just see this one? Listening online in Titusville, Florida. Thank you, John. And let me see if anybody else is actually doing a streaming thing here. Sounds great here in Lansing, says Darcy. Thank you, Darcy. So we're bad. We're nationwide. We had, like, easy access to all... of
the music?
The music.
It's right in there.
This ZZ Top. But could we...
yes.
Could we get that on?
I don't know if that's in the library.
North Bay, Ontario. One of my travel mates from on a trip to Cuba that I just took came from North Bay, Brad. But thank you. So we're all over. I wonder how people get turned on to all of this, to this show.
A variety of ways, I'm sure.
Well, wait a minute. Remember Stella... from Hamtramck told us that Governor Granholm could not remove somebody like Kwame Kilpatrick
unless they
were convicted or something like that.
Or convicted, right.
But here, and this is in quotes, let me see. Actually, there's no name at all on it. But they wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, the governor may remove at the, quote, appearance of impropriety at a lower level than indictment. So just the appearance of impropriety. And I would say that Kwame Kilpatrick has an appearance of
just a little one.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, online is still in mono. So what? Sorry, I didn't mean to. What, they want me out of one speaker and you out of the other?
I don't know. That might be scary.
I'm getting dizzy, aren't I? All right, let's see here. Who's been waiting the longest? Aaron in Lincoln Park. Hi, Aaron. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing today?
We're doing good.
Yeah, I was just curious because all the doctors, they're prescribing like Vicodin and Xanax, and that's getting really, really bad. Then how come like they want to prescribe Marinol pills, which is like liquid THC, or you can go to Southern California and you can get like an eighth of weed prescribed to you as opposed to like Vicodin or Xanax? And I was just curious, like, why wouldn't more doctors think of that around here or anything like that? You know what I'm saying?
I don't think they can do it, and there's specific laws. There's a number of states that have passed medical marijuana laws, and California is one of them, although Bushko has made any number of raids on people that are either providing that or, in some places, hospices. So they've taken terminally ill people and turned them into criminals. But you cannot do that. You couldn't do that in Michigan, Aaron, for instance.
Hey, you know who has a license out in California to get medical marijuana?
Who?
Snoop Dogg.
Snoop Dogg?
He said it on The View the other day.
Is that right?
Yeah, he said he has a medical condition.
Yeah.
And he's got a license and everything.
He get in
because for a while he said he had quit, you know.
Yeah.
And then
he's unhappy unless he's depressed.
Yeah.
But so if some of those laws have got to go, Aaron. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Here's John in Mount Clemens. John, you're on the air. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Good.
I just want to say I agree with Jolene. If McCain wins, I'm moving to Canada.
Well, out of here.
You're the first thing. And you'd probably just doom Snoop Dogg. The feds are probably going to be at his door tomorrow morning.
I was thinking, diggity dog, what are you doing? What are you?
She dropped a dime on him. That's what he said.
He said it on the air.
They might have.
He said it to millions and millions of people on national television.
Yeah.
No, you got me there. All right,
okay.
I did want to say is we got to get out of Iraq. I think people have forgotten about this because of the economy, but that's the direct result of the economy.
Sure.
Us being in Iraq.
And the economy is a direct result of Iraq, yeah.
Every Monday there's a war protest at 9 in Woodward at 4:45.
I'm usually there. Do you go you come all the way from Mount Clemens?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So you know who I am?
I know who you are. I've been listening to you for years.
No, but I mean,
do you know who I am when I show up? Like?
Sure, I do.
Okay, well, say hello to me tomorrow, because that's what I do. I go get my mail from the post office box there. So, yeah, so people, join us. You know, remember way back when Maurice from Detroit, what he wanted to talk about? He said his statement was that I could stop the country. I can't even get people to come out to this little anti-war vigil at the corner of 9 Mile and Woodward every Monday in Ferndale, 4:45 to 5:45.
Well, and also, you know what? I know it's been a cold, hard winter, but it's going to be a beautiful day tomorrow.
Let's rock.
Let's rock. I got a couple of meetings. Maybe I'll meet you there tomorrow, Peter.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I have a meeting, too. We have staff meetings, don't
we? Yes, we have serious business, but then we can go protest.
You got to go to both meetings?
I have two meetings. I'm special.
All right, John, say hello to remind me.
Oh, but wait, Pete, I got one more thing here.
Yeah.
Remind people about American Axle, who doesn't get much news coverage, but they've been out there for almost 2 months.
That's right.
And they've been getting asked to take up to a 50% pay cut. 50% pay cut.
That's amazing.
Wow.
And,
that's horrible.
If they're out there for 2 months and any support people can give them, it would be appreciated. The middle class is disappearing. Republicans are trying to make this a right-to-work state instead of a closed shop. And, you know, 50% pay cut, I mean, that's just mind-boggling.
It is. And there's going to be a big support rally. Do you have that information? I'm trying to look for it. Julie from Ann Arbor sent this to me. I think it's July 18th. I can't do the math. Yeah, that's right. Friday is the 11th. So it's Friday, April 18th. And actually, I got to find
April, you said July.
I said July?
Yeah.
April.
Yeah, wow.
Just checking.
Wow, yeah. this is not a. People say, yeah, but this must be a. What do you call it?
Yeah, hopefully it's
straight. I'm totally losing.
Moving right along. Yeah.
All right, John, I'll see you tomorrow. Have a good one. Thanks for joining us. Here it is. April 18th rally to support American Axle workers. Dear UAW sisters and brothers and friends of the union, as you well know, the UAW has been engaged in a strike against American Axle since February 26th. There's no end in sight. Workers I got to move this over a little because I'm missing a few words, at 29 GM plants have been laid off as a result of the strike, and the person writing, who is, I don't know, said, I've been on a picket line a couple of times at the AAM Hamtramck facility. The workers are amazing. So where is this now? I got to get down to it because this is not, it's going to be at Hart Plaza. 11:30 a.m. on Friday, April 18th, downtown Detroit, Hart Plaza, to support striking workers at American Axle. Well, why should you? You're not a UAW member. You're not even a union member. Why in the hell should you even care about these people? Because, you know, if they can bust the people that are the most organized, because if you're not a union, it's just you against the company, and all you can say is yes, sir, no, sir. You don't have a contract. You don't have any guarantees of anything, right? You're at, what do they call it, at will employee. And that's the will of the boss, not your will. So If they can do that to these unionized workers, believe it, they're after you next. Here's Mary Ann in Southfield. Mary Ann, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, hi, Pete. How are you doing?
Good, good.
Great, great. I have, first of all, a question for you and then a statement. The first one was I went and saw the Peak Oil movie.
Oh, were you there in the audience when I spoke?
Oh, it was great.
Yeah,
everybody should have gone.
Yeah, I forgot to even mention that. I spoke at a Sierra Club meeting, a Sierra Club of Southeastern Michigan, and there was this wonderful movie called The Power of Community, which is online, at least the trailer of it. And then I spoke some about my recent trip to Cuba. Well, good.
Excellent. Yeah, I just wanted to know, do they have problems with drugs like marijuana? Are they restricted? And what they can do, the people of Cuba?
I think they have a capital punishment, which I think is a disgrace. And I think they execute drug dealers. They don't execute a lot of people. Of course, the country that... who are the big executors? Like Iran and China and the United States?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And my my statement was that I agree with Jolene on that, you know, Randy Rhoads, that she's a strong radio host. And I think women like progressives like Jolene and I... And all women out there that are progressives need people like her. And another thing is Rush Limbaugh,
mm-hmm.
Hannity, and who's the other fellow, O'Reilly?
Yeah.
They've been saying things like feminazis to us for years.
Yeah.
You know, any women like Jolene, I can tell, a strong woman, that, you know, they've been putting us down for constantly, I'd say 20, 25 years.
At least.
Yeah. So I've had it. I've never heard anybody suspending them for any length of time or at all.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'll tell you, have you seen the Randy Rhoads video, though?
I haven't seen that.
It's pretty raw.
I'm going to have to get it.
I haven't even seen it. I'm going to go home and watch it after the show.
I am, too, yeah.
Well, it's at my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. And don't let the kids, unless... The kids have heard that before. All right. Thank you, Mary Ann. Thanks for joining us. And let's see if we can get through some of these calls quickly. Here is Eric in Canada. Eric, thanks for making our show international.
How you doing?
We're doing good.
Oh, this is my weekly call for you.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I'd just like to touch on what the gentleman beforehand there was talking about, why they don't legalize marijuana. He's kind of a little bit off base there by quite a bit because, okay, the fuel end of it, up here in Canada, they already make the stuff without the THCs and they use it for car parts and stuff because it's more stronger and yada, all the other stuff. The reason they don't legalize it is because anything that isn't black market has no money value to it. They got to keep the marijuana in black in a money value because if they were to ever legalize it, they deflate the price of it, and you'd see a whole bunch of these little puppet countries that America, like, well, you know, kind of props up. It's not a bad thing, but that you like to get into, go bankrupt, like, overnight.
I don't think there's a lot of countries that are exporting a lot of marijuana anymore. I don't even know if Mexico, there's probably still a bit of smuggling, but most of the marijuana is homegrown. What happened in Canada? I thought they were going to decriminalize it, and then Stephen Harper got in as prime minister.
What they did was they made the possession. They took it from being a court item to a summons sort of type of thing where it's not a criminal thing. It's more of a summary
civil infraction, as we call it,
like a parking ticket.
Yeah. All right. We just got a little bit of time left. Thank you for the report from Canada, Eric. And let's see. Here is David in Allen Park. Hi, David. David?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
David from Allen Park?
Hi, David.
Yes, I'd like to talk about John McCain.
Sure.
This guy is scary.
Yeah?
Really scary.
What scares you about him?
I believe that as soon as he gets in office, if he does, and I hope he doesn't, that he will start a war with Iran.
I don't know. Do you think the United States has the capacity? I mean, well, I'll tell you, if the United States just bombs Iran, Iran would retaliate with every resource possible. And if we bomb their territory with our planes, they could conceivably bomb our territory with car bombs and suicide bombers, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. If we do attack Iran, there will be a retaliation, and it will not be a good thing.
Okay, so are you out of here with me then? if he gets in?
What's that?
Are you, I said if McCain gets in, I'm out of here. You coming with?
Out of the country?
Yeah.
I'd rather move to Italy where I have family.
Hey. Italy sounds beautiful.
All right.
Let's go.
Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Here's Chris and Warren. Chris, it's got to be pretty quick. Go ahead.
Yep, favorite time of the night, guys.
Yeah.
Hello, Jillian and Peter.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to know, is anybody on our watch can recall if Bush has done anything we could praise him about? And then also, with McCain, that is scary because my best friend of over 15 years, he's not only pro-Republican, because we were talking about who we're going to vote for, and he said McCain. I said, how can you always go with a Republican?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it has to do with his church he belongs to. A lot of times they just discuss about just different issues or so and all this Christianity. And I'm a Christian, too, but I just don't see either of these guys doing a damn good for our country.
Well, I'll tell you, I was listening to a talk show the other night, and someone said that Bush had, I can't remember what the issue was, but they said that Bush had actually done something, for some legislation or some executive order or something that was good. And the host said, well, you know, even a blind squirrel finds an acorn once in a while.
Oh, my gosh.
All right.
The only good thing I can say is he likes dogs. He's got a couple cute little dogs. That's about it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, someone called me on this national show that I was doing on Nova Am Radio Network and said, has anybody in American history done more damage to the United States than George W. Bush? And I said, yeah, British Admiral, I can't think of his name, George Coburn, I think it was.
You rattled it off earlier.
Yeah.
Rattled.
Andrew Coburn, who burned the White House in 1814. You know, during the War of 1812. All right. Our last caller, pardon me, right here. Go ahead. You're on the air. Are you with me?
Hello.
Hi.
You know, wait a minute. Your subject is drinking and driving. Is that what you're doing?
No. Oh, I just getting off work. Yeah, what I had a question about is I got pulled over drinking and driving, and it's been a year almost, and it's almost cost me $16,000.
Wow.
What?
Yes. And what I was wondering, like when I was on work release in jail, they charge everybody a different price for staying in jail. Like it cost me $1,200, another guy like $2,000. And I thought everybody, you know, like when you're in jail, if you're, you know, supposed to be treated equal, and that to me, it seems crazy.
Well, I don't know what to say, not really knowing anything about that, and your phone is kind of acting up, and it's time for me to go. But
try to take a cab or get a ride. That's what I suggest.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for being our last caller. Well, Jillian Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
And stay tuned. A couple of interesting interviews next on Night Call.
This is WRIF.com. Of WRIF.com. Get the Riff Gear Shop and buy your favorite Riff wearables online. Use our online classifieds with tons of local and free listings. Or your 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Websites worldwide.
101 WRIF at WRIF.com. Everything rocks. Rocks.
Hanging around downtown by myself. I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yeah, there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy hair. Who's that lounging? Yeah. Who's that casting deep fear stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. Hanging around downtown by myself. I've had too much caffeine, and I was thinking about myself, and then there she was, in platform double suede. Yeah, there she was, like disco lemonade. smell sex and candlelit here. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting?
Baseball is back now. 101 WRIF and your Detroit Tigers want to send you on a rock and roll trip to see the Tigers take on the Toronto Blue Jays for not one, but two games. April 19th and 20th in Toronto. Want to get in on the action? Log on to WRIF.com or on Tigers.com/WRIF and tell us what you would do to see the Tigers in Toronto. You might win 2 nights hotel accommodations in downtown Toronto, $200 in gas cards to get you there and back, a pair of tickets to see the Detroit Tigers versus the Toronto Blue Jays on April 19th and 20th at Rogers Center, plus sweet Riff wearables and autographed Tigers memorabilia. Rockin' on the road with your Detroit Tigers at 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Yeah, I never liked school very well. It was kind of hellish. I mean, particularly for an ADD guy, you know, have to sit in those rows and have these mostly mean teachers, mostly boring instructional material. And so anything that I've taught, I owe to a few very innovative teachers in high school and also in college. But when we think of schools today being hellish, it's very frequently ones that are racked by violence, old infrastructure, underfunded. And we're not just talking about inner city schools like in the city of Detroit itself, but throughout our suburban areas, except for the very middle class and wealthy ones. There's an enormous problem in education. I don't know how many of you saw the newspaper the other day or heard it on television, but at Oak Park High, we're talking suburban here, there was an enormous fight. 6 kids are arrested by the police. A security guard's attacked. There's a crisis in education. Whether or not No Child Left Behind even begins to address it, maybe something for another program. But there are success stories here. There are people working innovatively in the classrooms and in the educational system. And a book was brought to my attention. It's by Brian D. Schultz, and the book is called Spectacular Things Happen Along the Way, Lessons from an Urban Classroom. And Brian D. Schultz is an assistant professor of education and honors faculty at Northeastern Illinois University. He also taught in the Chicago Public Schools, where a lot of this book is set, and in 2005 received the Educator of the Year Award from the Illinois Computing Educators. We're reaching him in a Chicago office. Brian Schultz, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter.
Yeah, so you were in, and sort of a metaphor, you were in the trenches, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was teaching in downtown Chicago in a school that was serving a housing project, notably the Cabrini-Green community.
Yeah, which is a pretty tough area, and which hasn't changed really much in the last 40 or 50 years, has it?
Although right now it's going through massive gentrification efforts, and they're trying to, the city and the Chicago Housing Authority are touting what they call the plan for transformation, which is to tear down the high-rise tenement buildings and make the land, which is highly sought after, just adjacent to the Magnificent Mile and the Gold Coast area, available to mixed-income families.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, the best schools that I always hear in the urban areas are let me put it a different way, the teachers that I know that are so committed to their craft as you are, they have some little spots of success. And you write about one, and spectacular things happen along the way. But in the main, the urban schools are just horrible, aren't they?
Typically, they struggle quite a bit. Usually underfunded, under-resourced. Oftentimes, the most highly qualified teachers do not end up in the urban schools.
Yeah. Now you're a Euro-American, and most of I would assume the Cabrini-Green school was an African-American school. How did this happen? Tell us a little about your personal story. I mean, were you drafted? Were you a volunteer? How did you wind up in a challenging school district?
Actually, my situation's pretty unique. I was in education for a number of years, but not teaching in a traditional sense. I had worked in the corporate world as an education and learning consultant, working with Fortune 500 companies to design curriculum, especially in areas of team building and leadership development, communication skills, and the like. and was pretty dissatisfied with the corporate world and decided to make the transition after having some experiences as an outward bound instructor, rock climbing and backpacking with kids, mostly from urban Atlanta and urban Charlotte when I was down in North Carolina, wanted to make the transition from the corporate world into the schools. Had a master's degree in elementary and experiential learning, and so went from a top floor office. Actually, you could see it from the school building where I ended up, just north of it in downtown Chicago in Cabrini Green.
So it was sort of a welcome Cotter situation, if people's memory go back to the 1970s. And
Well, in some ways, certainly the classroom environment was a tough environment, much like what you'd see in many of the media depictions, whether it's on sitcoms or whether in the movies. The big difference, though, was the way that I looked at the students. I saw them as in their capacity, their creativity, and their intelligence as something that I wanted to tap into rather than looking at them from a deficit model.
Isn't there, even if it's unspoken, the idea that many of these inner-city urban schools are just sacrifice zones? People know that more of the graduates are going to wind up in prison than in college, and that they're just sort of parking them there because that's the law. They have to be in school till at least they're 16.
Right. Certainly says a lot about our society. I do agree with you, though. I think that schools are what has become like a sorting machine. Depending on your socioeconomic status and depending on your race and ethnicity, it's going to determine what type of school you end up in and what type of instruction you get and the resources that are available to you while you're in school.
Brian Schultz is the author of a brand new book. It's published by Teachers College Press. It's tcpress.com. It's called Spectacular Things Happen Along the Way, Lessons from an Urban Classroom. Well, tell us the story that's related in your book, Brian.
Sure. Basically, the story of Spectacular Things Happen Along the Way is about a teacher's journey, while simultaneously it's about kids from an urban housing project being political about what's most important to them. So what ended up happening was I was in doctoral studies while I was also a teacher, and I was reading about all these abstract conceptualizations and theories about students needing to be the centerpiece. Students needed to be the starting point for the curriculum. And oftentimes what we see in schools is a very top-down approach where the teacher has all the answers and directs instruction in a very prescriptive manner. And so what I wanted to do was to see if this theory could actually be applied in action. And so what I ended up doing was asking the students what was a problem in the community that they wanted to solve. And within 1 hour's time, they came up with almost 100 different problems that affected themselves and their community.
Wow.
Everything from litter in the park to teenage pregnancy to wanting a kid president. They came up with all sorts of different ideas. But as they looked at their list, they realized that about 40 of the problems on the list had to do with the inadequacy and the shameful state of their school building. And so unanimously they focused on that being the issue they wanted to solve. How do we get a new school building in the city of Chicago and make good on a promise, actually, that the school board had made to the community about building a new school about 6 years earlier?
And what tell us some about the children, their age, their ethnic mix, if there is one, and what you saw as their potential.
Right. The students were 10 to 12 years old. They were all fifth graders in a self-contained classroom, meaning that they all stayed with the teacher, with me, the entire school day, except for a class where they might have gone to a gym or to art class.
Anyway, let me just interrupt you. So they don't do that old thing, you go to social studies, then you go to math, then you go to shop, then you go to... This is like the old one-room schoolhouse.
In some ways. I mean, so the class was bounded to this particular classroom, and it actually followed the middle school theory model where you stay with the teacher all day long. Interestingly enough, though, as a side note, we really didn't have, it's 10 o'clock, put your reading away, it's time for math, because the nature of solving this problem of getting a new school building allowed for an integrated classroom to happen where all the subject matter was interconnected because it was a real-life problem, and real-life problems, by their very nature, interconnect the disciplines of knowledge, the subject areas that we traditionally think about how school is broken down.
And these were all African-American kids?
Right, exactly. So I was certainly an admitted outsider coming into Cabrini Green, working with the students in this classroom.
Any idea what they thought? And I won't embellish it. But any idea what their perception of you was initially?
Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting to walk down the halls when I first started teaching at the school. I was walking past the other fifth grade classroom, and this is just an example to characterize my outsiderness. I saw a parent scolding her son because he had been getting in trouble in the other fifth grade classroom. And she, I was within earshot, but she didn't see me, and then either did her son. And what she was telling him was that if he didn't start behaving, she was going to send him to that new white teacher's classroom. As a punishment. I was the punishment.
Well, that's interesting because certainly from all that I know, and I know a considerable number of teachers, a number of them that teach in the Detroit public schools, it's not like the black teachers are lax in their discipline. In fact, sometimes they're extraordinary. They think that's what's lacking, and they're extraordinary disciplinarians. So what was the threat?
Right. I mean, I don't know what the threat was, but it was that, you know, I was certainly not seen as necessarily a welcome entity in the school. And so what I realized my challenge was to figure out how to build relationships with the school, with the community, with the parents. And so that was something I highly sought after, and that's one of the reasons why I believe the classroom was so effective, was because we found allies in people that might not have been so readily wanting to partner with me.
Well, I want to hear more of the story, but I wonder, did you ever get called into the principal's office and have the principal say, Mr. Schultz, what are you doing?
Without a doubt. That happened quite a bit. Although, excuse me, one of the things that I think was really interesting was to make sure that I looked to the administration of the school as that partner, as an ally. And so I often looked to them for wisdom. Both the principal and assistant principal had been within the community for years, if not decades. And so I think that my willingness to listen and learn from them allowed me to do things that might have been considered dangerous teaching or risky teaching.
Well, that was one of the things I was thinking. You know, the old adage in bureaucracies, if you want to get along, go along. And often when people attempt within bureaucracies, corporations, government, whatever, and they start bringing in innovative methods, the people that have been ensconced in the bureaucracy for a long time find it really threatening.
And I think that at some level it might have been threatening, but at the same time, in an interesting role reversal, the fifth graders in room 405 were actually giving voice to the principals and to many of the teachers in the school, because the school had been the school as a broader entity had been promised a new school building. And it was an erstwhile promise. It had never been followed through on, except for the land had been raised and about $300,000 had been put into preparing the site. But amidst those gentrification efforts that are going on in the community, the school was never built, perhaps holding out for new folks moving into the area.
Well, let me say that if people want to see the website the kids put up about this project, it's Project Citizen 405, projectcitizen405.com. My guest is Brian D. Schultz. He's written spectacular things happen along the way, lessons from an urban classroom. Now, you said your fifth graders voted that the project that was most meaningful or that would take into account so many problems that they as students faced would be to get a brand new school. Tell me the story. How did they move along on the school?
Well, you have to know a little bit more about the school, I think, that the school didn't have a lunchroom, did not have a gym, did not have an auditorium. On the fourth floor, we had to wear hats, gloves, and coats because the heat didn't make it up to our classroom.
How old was the building?
It was actually only 44 years old.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's surprising, but you know, it kind of raises an eyebrow as to what the plans were when they actually designed this school and why it was built in the first place as it was. You know, we ate in a hallway. There was not a formal lunchroom in the school. The windows were frosted over with age. They were made of bulletproof plastic, yet they were pocked with bullet holes. Natural light didn't come into the classrooms.
Right. Well, when I said that school was hellish for me. This must have been hellish for you and for the kids, and to expect that to be a creative learning experience really defies what one knows about the circumstances under which that occurs. So continue the story. So kids got an impossible dream. I mean, they ought to be listening to Man from La Mancha or something like that, because it just didn't seem... I mean, here you got a building built for them that was must have known that the white administration in the 60s that built it for the black kids in the 60s knew that they were giving them something substandard. So how did they proceed from here?
Obviously a pretty clear message to the kids of, you know, what their worth was in the mind of those that conceived this sort of school, and the fact that it was not maintained and no resources were actually put into it over the last decade. So what the students actually did with identifying all of these major symptoms and problems of the school building being inadequate, they decided to come up with an action plan in order to solve this problem. They came up with everything from writing letters and emails to producing a video documentary to inviting local legislators in or producing a website, like you mentioned. And so the whole idea was to get the word out and to rally support in order to realize that perfect solution, as they called it, a whole new school building.
Mm-hmm. And success?
Well, success is kind of a mixed bag, if you will. As they went on the journey actually encompassed the entire year's curriculum. So for 7 months from the time that I posed that initial question of what was a problem that they wanted to solve, we were on a journey together. And we saw lots of changes happen in the school building. For instance, new windows had been ordered for the entire school. Lights were replaced. Drinking fountains were installed. And believe it or not, there was actually soap dispensers installed in the bathrooms. If you can believe it, there weren't actually soap dispensers in any of the bathrooms in the school building.
But in a way, the information that all implied, all the improvements, were that you weren't going to get a new building.
Right. And so. What ended up happening over the course of the school year was that the students examined alternative solutions. Certainly they wanted to forge ahead for a brand new school building, one that had been promised to the community, but they also realized that they had to look to other alternatives. One was combining with another neighborhood school. Another was seeking out repairs within the school building itself. Another was doing nothing at all. So they had a systematic approach beyond their action plan, and it wasn't necessarily just to get a new school building, but it was to bring attention to their inequitable situation.
So, in other words, they actually were developing a broader social scope. In the series in which your book, Spectacular Things Happen Along the Way, it's published by Teachers College Press, and it says the Teaching for Social Justice series. And it's interesting. I like the concept on one hand, but the idea that people should just have decent schools, not even good schools, but decent schools, it doesn't even seem like social justice. That seems like what we should all have as a matter of course. I mean, that maybe I'm just splitting hairs because it's something.
No, I can't agree more. And I think that, you know, what frustrates me most is that there's this expectation, especially with No Child Left Behind and this hyper-accountability that we see in current educational policy right now, especially in the high-stakes testing, the punitive high-stakes testing, is that there's this expectation of equity, right? Every kid should score at a certain percentile, or every kid should be able to do this or that by a certain year. But there's not a foundation of equity. And so for me, that's highly problematic. And so even though the rhetoric says that every kid can succeed, when you're dealt a hand where you're in a school that's just shameful and shamefully inadequate, it certainly begs the question of are we actually trying to have these particular students succeed?
Well, Brian Schultz, it's interesting that you use the word shameful. It's one I often employ because it's shameful that this country experiences so much of what it does in terms of the way it treats its citizens in a country that brags about being the richest country in the world, and yet you have schools, and again, not just in the urban areas, but in our suburban areas, rural areas as well, that just don't meet up to a standard necessary for education, and yet in the poorest areas, I mean, mean, certainly race plays a role in all this, but ultimately it's class, it's poor, and poor kids everywhere have, as you said, don't begin from a base of equity. Often it's poor food, broken homes, they don't have parents that are educated and will read to them, and a host of other things that I'm probably not neglecting to mention. Tell us about how the students reacted, because the students, even forgetting about the physical plant, the students are also often challenged and challenging, right?
Right, without a doubt. And I think that that's an important to note, is that what at first they really challenged this idea. Instead of having that top-down curriculum where I was telling them to do workbook pages and busy work that so many teachers in urban classrooms do, I was looking to them for what was most important and worthwhile to them. What were their needs, wants, and desires? And so at first this was, they were a little skeptical of me. They didn't understand this idea of sharing authority with them. And so they at first tested the boundaries, but they realized that it wasn't about me and it wasn't about my authority. It was about trying to solve this problem that was important to them. And so what the results that happened out of that was students came to school early. They left late. They came in on Saturdays, not because they were thinking about, oh, I need to do extra schoolwork, but they saw this as anti-schoolwork. This was solving a problem that was important to them in their community and something that they could actually work to make a difference on.
And learning skills along the way, or the classroom material that most, like I said, I found so dreadfully boring and hateful. I mean, being forced to do math and social studies and all that stuff, man, that, oh, but so, as I said along the line somewhere in our discussion, there's a lot of teachers that think that kids, particularly poorer kids that they see as acting out more and misbehaving, what they need is strict discipline. What they need are substitute father figures in situations where one is lacking at home. So your lessons from an urban classroom, which is the subtitle of your book, kind of confronts that theory, doesn't it?
Right. It certainly wasn't my experience. I think the idea is that, at least what I learned from my students, was the idea that if a teacher provides the space, the opportunity, and the responsibility for taking control of one's own learning, that wonderful things can happen as a result. And so certainly there needs to be a balance of what kind of structures are in place in the classroom, but I think that the students and the teacher in concert together can develop those. And so the expectations were for all of us rather than for a particular kid who might have been acting out in another classroom.
How did you react to students that did, quote, misbehave? Was that just done in the traditional manner? You're out of here. Go to the principal's office or the counselor's office, or did you work any innovative ways with that?
To be honest with you, Peter, this particular group of students, I had very few behavior problems because I think that the students actually took it into their own hands to kind of keep everybody in check. It doesn't mean that every day was this wonderful, rosy day, that there weren't any issues or any confrontations. In actuality, there were lots of strong deliberations and heated discussions because we were solving a real curriculum problem and that everybody in the room was passionate about. But as far as the behavior problems, which I may have experienced in previous years, didn't exist, and I really credit it to the fact that the students were focused on something that was important to them rather than something that might have been important to either the school district or the school or maybe the teacher deciding that this is what you need to know.
Mm-hmm. Now, this has all been extremely informative. I wonder, though, is this hyperbole, though? Spectacular things happen along the way. It was good that this all happened. It looks like there are lessons for other teachers. It's good to get to windows and drinking fountains and soap, but would you qualify this as spectacular, or is there a part that needs to be added to this?
Well, I think that, you know, where the title came from was a concerned citizen had written to the students after she had heard about the
the student's project. And she had said, you know, you're already raising your learning and your education by doing what you're doing. And I found that spectacular things happen along the way when you're fighting for what you believe in. Mm-hmm. And the students latched onto that. And so the students kept on using that in their daily journal entries, that they were seeing spectacular things happen along the way. And so so that's kind of the nexus for the title. But I also think that I talk about something that I say is it's process rather than product. So certainly we were striving for a new school building. That was the ultimate goal of the classroom. But reality is that it's the experience that experiences that happen in the course of action that are the ones that are going to be able to be transferred to other situations in the student's life, in my life. And I think that that's where that spectacular part is still happening. For instance, last week the students were invited to an educational research conference in New York City. So now this is several years later, but yet they're talking to teachers and teacher educators about what it takes to motivate city kids because of the spectacular things that they did in the past.
And Brian Schultz, about 30 seconds, but now you're a professor of education at Northeastern Illinois University. Is it as rewarding, or is it now you're able to teach the theories that that you learned in the school?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's I have mixed feelings about it. I think that whereas I miss the interaction with young people every day, I really believe that working with future educators about the possibilities of looking to your students for what's most worthwhile and that becoming the curriculum has tremendous promise and hopefulness. And so I really enjoy what I'm doing now.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Our guest on the Peter Werbe Show has been Brian D. Schultz. He's the author of Spectacular Things Happen Along the Way, Lessons from an Urban Classroom. It has a foreword by Carl A. Grant. And Jonathan Kozel, author of Amazing Grace, says, "Once I began reading, I couldn't put it down. The power here is in the details. It's a marvelous, important book and is badly needed at a moment when the values it upholds are under an unrelenting assault from the forces of reactionary ignorance." Well, you can't get a better recommendation about education than from Jonathan Kozel. Thank you so much, Brian Schultz, for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks, Peter. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Baseball is back now. 101 WRIF and your Detroit Tigers want to send you on a rockin' road trip to see the Tigers take on the Toronto Blue Jays for not one, but two games. April 19th and 20th in Toronto. Want to get in on the action? Log on to WRIF.com or on Tigers.com/WRIF and tell us what you would do to see the Tigers in Toronto. You might win 2 nights hotel accommodations in downtown Toronto, $200 in gas cards to get you there and back, a pair of tickets to see the Detroit Tigers versus the Toronto Blue Jays on April 19th and 20th at Rogers Center, plus sweet ripped wearables and autographed Tigers memorabilia. Rockin' on the road with your Detroit Tigers at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Oh,
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. And one of the things I like about doing this show is I learned so much. I interview people, authors, and people that do all sorts of work in our society to alter it, to change conceptions, to bring us information, to entertain us. And here's an issue that's confronting our community, confronting our state. It's a medical issue, but one I've heard a lot about, probably you too, but it occurred to me I do not know the definitions. And that's stem cell research, that is violently opposed by some people, and yet others see it as a key to bringing us real breakthroughs in medicine. Joining me in the studio is Michael Rubion. He is a co-filmmaker with Deborah Orley of a documentary film about embryonic stem cell research and the impact Michigan's restriction on research have on the lives of six featured families. And he's made the film with Deborah Orley. Also in the studio, Amber Shin. She's the communications director for the Stem Cell Research Ballot Question Committee. And they're working to put the stem cell research question on the November ballot in Michigan. Michael Rubion and Amber Shin, welcome to the Peter Werby Show. Glad to have both of you here.
Hey, Peter.
Maybe we could do this with Michael Rubion, since your film, Life is for the Living, takes up also the scientific and medical questions. My wife said, as I left, she said, what are human embryonic stem cells, or what are stem cells, period? I said, I don't know, but I'm going to find out. Can you give us a little intro to that?
Well, there are many different types of stem cells in your body. We have all different kinds. We have adult stem cells, which are tissue-specific stem cells, and we also have amniotic stem cells, umbilical cord stem cells. These are different. There are different various types. What scientists believe are the most promising form of stem cells are what we call embryonic stem cells. And embryonic stem cells have the ability to become any type of cell. So where an adult stem cell is already specialized or has already taken shape into a certain type, maybe it's a blood-forming stem cell.
Yeah. Well, for instance, a colleague of mine, her father had stem cells, heart stem cells, implanted in his heart in an operation in a foreign country because they're not allowed here, which strengthened his heart. So that's like the use of adult stem cells.
Right. These are stem cells that have already taken shape into a type of cell.
Mm-hmm.
What's unique about embryonic stem cells is that they can become any kind of cell: brain cells, muscle cells, bone marrow cells, cells that might not be able to be generated from a cell that's already taken a certain form.
Now, there's great opposition to this, particularly by the religious right and some in the conservative movement itself, that says, I'm not sure what the objection is. Usually what happens with the embryonic stem cell in fertilization clinics is they're considered medical waste and they're thrown away, right?
That's right.
That's correct.
Yeah. So I don't get it. What I mean, sometimes it's hard to speak for the opposition, but can you and either of you,
you're not the only one that doesn't get it. You know, some folks believe that it's not right to use those fertilized eggs for research, and I'm not here to challenge those beliefs. You know, I respect that a lot. But that said, there isn't a right to deny Michigan families of the possible cures and therapies that come from embryonic stem cell research. I mean, it's just that they have a belief that life begins right when it's fertilized, and that's what that group of people believe.
But you can throw it out, but you can't use it for research.
That's right. You can let possible cures for Michigan families literally go up in smoke rather than devote them to possible cures.
Well, Michael Rubion, in Life is for the Living, is this film, is the content of it, is it both educational in terms of what you laid out, but also features the impact on families? And how does it have an impact on families?
Absolutely. Our film really seeks to address this issue from four different perspectives: the people who might one day benefit, the politics and the debate that's going on across the country, the science and what researchers believe is so promising about this research, and the hope that this provides. So we really seek to educate people about this issue and also give them a sense of what the stakes are and what this is all about.
And what were these families? Were these families that had medical problems but were denied access to cures?
These are families that have devastating diseases and injuries that are just currently incurable. So families with juvenile diabetes, Parkinson's disease, spinal cord injury, diseases and injuries that we just really don't have the ability to solve at this point in time. And scientists believe that embryonic stem cell research holds promise for developing new treatments and cures,
mm-hmm.
potentially.
And you were able to get Mike Wallace, who's a University of Michigan alum, and you go to the University of Michigan right now. How were you able to hook up with somebody of that prominence?
Well, there was great interest at the university to engage one of the University of Michigan's most active supporters, Mike Wallace, who's graduated from the university several years back. And Mr. Wallace was really interested in being a part of this, and we were thrilled that he was willing to tape the introduction. It's an important issue and a compelling one, and he really wanted to be involved.
And the film is how long?
The film is an hour. It really does a great job of explaining this issue very succinctly, but also very thoroughly.
Well, you're in the University of Michigan film program, aren't
yes.
you? Yeah. Now, this is actually fairly unusual, isn't it, to have something like this made with a prominent person in the media? I mean, or do all students knock out our complex videos like you've made?
Absolutely. Well, Deborah and I really worked hard to develop this into something that people would be interested in seeing. And so it is unique for a student to be involved in a project like this, but I certainly believe that if you put your mind to it, you can do it.
All right, I want to talk more about the film, but let's bring Amber Shin back into our discussion. Amber, you're the communications director for the Stem Cell Research Ballot Question Committee. Now, this is going to be a ballot proposal. This is where you have to go out and get signatures, put it on the ballot. And,
correct.
Yeah, tell us some about it.
So right now we're in the petition collecting phase. When you try to get an issue on the ballot, you collect signatures, and we need 500,000, roughly 500,000 signatures from Michigan citizens to get this on the ballot. So that's where we're at right now.
Mm-hmm. And what's driving this? I mean, in terms of the people, I mean, is it people that have had experience with this, or is this the medical community? In other words, oftentimes when there's ballot considerations, people have had some experience, or they want to, you know, reform government, or they want to abolish this or allow that. What do you know what is driving people within this committee?
You know, it's a remarkable collection of people. It's nonpartisan, so it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. It's Michigan families, patients, patient advocacy groups, community leaders, business leaders across the state. Everyone's come together to help move this forward because it's so important to Michigan.
Yeah, and there's an, by the way, when I said earlier about the religious right, that does not necessarily mean partisan, because the opposition includes oftentimes conservative religious people of both parties, and the opposition, I'm sorry, the support of stem cell research also comes from both parties as well. That's pretty hard. 500,000 signatures. Does it seem almost daunting? And needs funding as well, right?
Well, certainly.
Yeah.
We can always use some funding. We're ahead of schedule in getting signatures, and we have a great group of very devoted volunteers out getting tens of thousands of signatures. We've got them from Sault Ste. Marie to Southwest Michigan, and from Marquette down to Monroe.
Now, if you're in Illinois or Indiana or Ohio, the states that border us, can you do embryonic stem cell research there? Because it's very restrictive in Michigan, isn't it?
Well, there are many different states that have different types of restrictions. States like Michigan have more restrictive laws associated with them. For example, in California, they passed an initiative in 2004 that allowed state funding to go toward embryonic stem cell research, and they established a center, the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. And so different states do have resources available for this. Michigan just happens to have laws that restrict this.
How did those come about? How did those laws, and are they must be fairly recent, because the whole thing with embryonic stem cell research is fairly recent.
Well,
that's kind of the snag. The 1978 law restricting embryonic stem cell research, the destruction of an embryonic stem cell for research was from 1978. Embryonic stem cell research, though, has only been around for the last 10 years. That's why it's kind of an ill fit, and we need to fix what we've got in the books.
Wow, so it goes back that far. That's I didn't realize that. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. Amber Shin from the Stem Cell Research Ballot Question Committee is with us, and also Michael Rubian, who is co-filmmaker with Deborah Orley of Life is for the Living. And you can go to their website, which is lifeisfortheliving.org. There will also be a link on my site, Peter Werbe. And Amber Shin, is there a website also for your effort?
Yes, there is. You can go to curemichigan.com, CUREMichigan.com.
Okay, and we'll give that we'll give that again as the program progresses. Michael Rubian, tell us some about these six families and one maybe. How did you find them?
We were introduced to these different families just through different people who are involved with this issue, and really what we were looking for were families that had a story to tell. And so what we really tried to find are people who have compelling stories that can help illustrate what this really means to people. And so one family we interviewed, two grandparents have juvenile diabetes, and one grandparent has lost both of his legs to the disease, and the other grandparent had to have a combined kidney and pancreas transplant as a result. And then their granddaughter has type 1 diabetes now. And so watching them interact with their granddaughter as they see that, you know, it's possible that she would have some of these horrible complications really emphasizes why there's so much hope that there might be something to help them.
I know you had a showing in Ann Arbor. Is this going to be a film that we're going to be able to see somewhere, I hope?
Absolutely. We've had requests from all over the state and all over the country, but we're hoping to have screenings coming very soon here in May, perhaps middle of May, mm-hmm. and we look forward to them.
And you're quoted in a University of Michigan News Service release. You say, stem cell research is one of the most misunderstood biological endeavors in our medical landscape today. Why is it misunderstood?
I think it's misunderstood because there isn't enough information out there that really gives people the facts. And that's what our film really looks to do. It looks to just give people the information that they require, the facts that they need, so that they can better make a decision. We're not really interested in telling people what to think, you know, or what they should do, just so that they have all the information at their disposal, and then they can make a good decision.
Amber Shin, I don't remember exactly, but it seems to me when public opinion polls are taken, people overwhelmingly support the idea of research. Am I correct in that? Do you have any?
It's true. About 70% of Michigan voters right now really support stem cell research and embryonic stem cell research. They think it's a great idea, and they really see that it's got real value to them and to Michigan families in general.
Yeah, it's kind of hard, I would think, even if you have a philosophical or religious objection to really say, well, you know, this is never going to happen to me or to my parents or to my kids, and there are so many dreadful diseases that cause such you know, harm to us and such heartache to us and our families that people would think, let's go wherever. Either of you can answer this. What is exactly the objection to it?
Like I said before, the objection really is they feel that life, there is a group of people that believe that life begins at the very second that an egg is fertilized, even if that happens in, say, a petri dish in an in vitro fertilization facility. And so they believe that that embryo shouldn't be destroyed. And when you're conducting research, that embryo does need to be destroyed, even if it's one that would be thrown away in the trash or is not fit for implantation during fertility treatment, or, you know, there are many reasons why it wouldn't be useful or viable.
So the people must bring this this illogical conclusion up to them, and either of you know, what do they say? Okay, no, that's all right.
It's a very difficult decision for some people to make, because they can very clearly see that in one hand you've got potential for cures, and in the other hand you're throwing them away. Right. And a lot of people really have a difficult time finding the right answer within themselves. And that's something every Michigan voter is going to need to do in November. Mm-hmm.
And the political opposition to it, is it exactly aligned with the anti-abortion people? Is it coming out of the same forces or...
I think to a degree, yes. Either they don't have the correct information, like Michael had talked about, because it's so misunderstood, or it comes from that anti-abortion group,
yeah.
Or Right to Life, or certain other groups.
Yeah, Michael Rubian, have you found objection to your film? Is there, or has this been completely well received across the board?
I think our film has been really well received. We worked so tirelessly to make sure that every single minute of it was factual and accurate, and we have over 15 different researchers, political leaders, and experts involved with this issue, ranging from former Attorney General Janet Reno to Governor Granholm, Senator Carl Levin, and we really worked to try and present a really factual case. And so I think it's been received so well because people have really been motivated to see what the issue is all about.
Yeah. When we were talking, or in fact, I'm not sure that we ran through the potential for solving the problems of a number of diseases. If we have them, I'd do well to mention them again. What people always talk about, Parkinson's disease, but even things like diabetes, that would...
Correct. Everyone knows somebody that can benefit from embryonic stem cell research, be, you know, sickle cell anemia. There's hope for breast and prostate cancer, Huntington's, chorea, spinal cord injuries, Alzheimer's, juvenile diabetes. There's so many afflictions, diseases, problems that can have potential to be cured here.
We're almost talking about everything that afflicts us. We can all be Methuselahs.
Senator Tom Harkin actually states that he believes over 100 million Americans might one day benefit from the results of embryonic stem cell research, and that's a big number.
Well, I think, and this is such good news, that both of you are way ahead of the curve, because both information, as typified by myself, who knew very little about all this at the beginning, but Michael Rubin, your film, and Amber Shin, your effort to put this on the ballot really would be an advance. But is this seen as really the magic bullet? Is like they say, okay, we get research rights, and then probably in about 2 or 3 months, all those diseases are off the board?
There's absolutely no way of knowing. But the only way we'll ever find out is if we try. And to stop promising research from taking place removes the word search from the research process. And the goal of doing scientific research is to look and to search for the answers to questions. So the only way to allow these types of potential cures or new treatments to be discovered is to allow scientists to do them. And so in educating the public, it's really important that people understand how scientists need the ability to continue on with their work.
Mm-hmm. And so this... but it's not completely an open question. I mean, there's already been work done with stem cells.
Absolutely, absolutely. There have been breakthroughs in different fields of stem cell biology that lead scientists to believe that this is promising. There have already been new types of discoveries made with skin cells. But the key here is that in order to make those discoveries, embryonic stem cells were utilized. And so scientists believe that these are the gold standard, per se, for scientific research. And this idea that we're on the cusp of a medical revolution, per se, in breakthroughs, is exciting to many. But it's important to also remember that it takes time. And that's not to say that tomorrow morning, if this were to all be happening, we would have cures, but we'd sure be a heck of a lot closer.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being on the program. But before we go, Amber Shin, I want to have you again give people the basic information. They can go to your website, curemichigan.com. And is this something that an individual listening could be motivated to take part in themselves? I assume you usually need canvassers, right?
Definitely. You know, stop by the website, curemichigan.com. Sign up and request a petition. We'll send you one so you can sign and help us get this on the ballot. Volunteer. Sign sign up to be on the email list and get more information, and we'll keep you posted.
All right. Well, yes, please do. I was going to say we can report back to people. And Michael Rubion, you and your co-filmmaker, Deborah Orley, have put together the film Life is for the Living, and your website is lifeisfortheliving.org. Lifeisfortheliving.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And, of course, people can best avail themselves of your film by watching it. And you said there's going to be some public showings. What if there's people listening? They have a church group, a union, or something like that. Can they go to this website and hook up a showing?
Absolutely. Please visit our website, lifeisfortheliving.org. You'll find how to contact us there. Send us an email. Give us a call. We're always happy to talk to anyone who wants to have this shown and screen it.
Michael Rubion and Amber Shin, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
This is WRIF.com.
I have a present for you.
Big blocks of riff rock.
What are you trying to say?
It's a Blood Party weekend on 101 WRIF. Blocks of your favorite riff rockers all weekend.
Amazing.
Plus, keep it locked on the riff for your chance to win tickets to the Monster Energy AMA Supergrass at Ford Field, Saturday, April 12th. One lucky riff winner will also score four times the adrenaline with four seats in the front row. Great tickets to the Monster Energy AMA Supergrass still available at all Ticketmaster locations. Click on Ticketmaster.com and get the special Riff discount tickets for just $10.01. The password is 101-WRIF.
And the best way to start a fun-filled day of being a good citizen is with
the Riff Block Party Weekend from 101-WRIF.
Hey, look at me. How else am I going to face the day?
Everything that rocks. From Detroit Rock City.
I'm transmitting rage.
Home to the 8-count indicted Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick.
Well, I think I just delivered that message.
He's been an all-around naughty boy.
I'm not going to comment on that.
And maybe even has cooties.
I am not even going to go there.
This is 101 WRIF.
WRIF HD1 Detroit.
The
Thank you.
Diet Pepsi Max and 101 WRIF wants you to wake up and text in to win. Right now, text in keyword WAKE to 71913, and you're in the running to win great prizes that'll wake you up, including an iPod Nano with SoundDock or a trip to Las Vegas. Standard text messaging fees apply. From Diet Pepsi Max, grab a Diet Pepsi Max and kick your mind and body back into gear and wake up at 101 WRIF. The
Win.